Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Doc Stanley, Sports in Depth, on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Show. See, on Sports in Depth of the show, Larry Hardesty will open things up for us.
Welcome to Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley on the Blake Radio Network. On each and every show, Doc takes you inside the world of sports to hear from the movers, shakers, and decision makers. I know you thought there were seven wonders of the universe, where here's the eighth, Doc Stanley.
And always opening prayer, John Coltrane. Dear Lord, happily titled. Dear Lord, thank you for another Sunday. Thank you, Lord, for the little things we so largely take for granted. Thank you for being our God. Thank you for all things good and wonderful. Give us how much love, not what we want, what we thank you for Christ, died on the cross, and had right to feel. Thank you, dear Lord, for blessings unseen, unacknowledged to our service. Let our show be another great show. In Jesus, amen. Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul, Sam Sports Network, the show. Harvey, is that you?
That's me, Doc. How's it going, guy?
Ladies and gentlemen, one of the legendary writers, one of the guys who knows the game as few has, who's written about it as few can, and stands in the class by himself. And I remember, your Yankee Stadium book, and I just could not put, every time you turned a page, there was something that was so informative. I remember Monty Irvin, a man who you know so well, we talked about his first game. I mean, he was coming to the plate with a chance to go 5 for 5 and had stole home plate. And Justino Baby Lewis is joining us. We're going to have Mel Smith Jr. join
us
also.
Hey, Doc, how you doing?
Okay, Justino, say hello to Harvey.
Harvey, welcome aboard, man. This is a crazy show, but you're going to enjoy it.
Anything with Doc, I'll enjoy.
Okay.
Fenway Park, what a great, historic ballpark. And you look at the plays that come out of it. You know, Ted Williams, the last man to hit 400. You know, ironically, 2 years ago, Jim Rice, who went into the Hall of Fame, was a lot of ways like the Jackie Robinson, as he was the first African-American, Harvey, to make it in his last year of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of that going around and coming around in the book also.
And the Red Sox, in the words of our late great friend Art Rush Jr., the last team to acquire African-American, Elijah Pumpsy Green. What is it about Fenway Park that set you on his mission to write the book, Harvey?
Well, the Remembering Yankee Stadium, which you have, I'm sure, read cover to cover and by word, was a nice success. And my publisher thought that Fenway should be the next book, and it is the next book out now, and is a twin to the Remembering Yankee Stadium. Also, I'll confess on the air, people change their religions. I've also changed my rooting interest. I don't want to make you guys cry. But I was a lifelong Yankee fan. I've written 8 books about the Yankees, hundreds of articles. And also, I wrote for the team for 18 years. And on this day of heroes returning to the stadium and old-timers, et cetera, this guy switched his allegiance. And I am now a full-fledged and very proud member of Red Sox Nation.
Red Sox Nation.
Red Sox
very
Nation.
Good.
Just because I found a better way.
Oh, wow. The books that you're writing, I don't know, I get a feeling or an idea that you're writing about the stadium, but you are talking about the stories dealing with that stadium, the history, the stories, the good human interest stories, the anecdotes that you experience within, am I correct, within the dome of that stadium, in other words.
Right, to coin a new expression, you hit the nail on the head.
Oh, wow. Me and my big hammer. Okay. Because, no, it's interesting. It's interesting way of writing.
It is.
I think maybe metaphorically, that you're talking about a stadium, but then you are talking about the family within that stadium and the history and the, you know, and the players and everything. So that's the impression that I get.
Yeah, basically, I don't want to seem conceited, but I think I have invented a new genre. I teach oral history and cultural history at Dartmouth College, and I train many students to do this kind of thing. And basically, this is my 41st sports book.
Wow.
So I got to this stage by doing, you know, many different books. I did Nolan Ryan's autobiography, Holtzman's autobiography, and Tony Dorsett's autobiography.
Wow.
And all three of those, that triple header, really was getting these people to tell their stories. But all of the books about them, I also got input from other people.
Right,
so it's
right,
not
right.
only the story told by, let's say, Tony Dorsett.
It's input by peers, colleagues.
All of that together.
You mentioned Tony Dorsett, and it's amazing. I remember at the Millrose Games, Dan O'Brien, who was Olympic champion, and it's funny, you know, he was saying, I said, you know, Dan, growing up, idols, role models, he said, all I wanted to be was number 33 and running the ball for the Dallas Cowboys. He's a big Cowboy fan, and Tony Dorsett.
Making them miss, right? Making other guys miss you. That was Tony's
evading
motto.
Them, evading the tackles, you mean?
Yeah, making them miss. That's what he has in the book.
You can't talk about Fenway Park, and I think the biggest figure ever there has been other than the splendid splinter, the last man to hit 400, the guy that won two triple crowns, Harvey, and didn't win the MVP. I mean, you know, Ted had a period in 41, he hits 400, and Joe DiMaggio wins the MVP. The next year, he went to triple crown, and the words of the great Bill Shannon, when Joe Gordon won MVP, he said, you know, only thing Joe Gordon led the league in the 42 was errors. You know, what was this?
He was not a likable personality for many of the press. He called them the knights of the keyboard. He'd give the finger to them. He would be abusive, and he made up rules for the Red Sox clubhouse. I discovered this, the press couldn't get in. It was a Ted Williams rule. They had to wait until he cooled off, and then they got in there.
Wow.
There was a lot of enmity to the guy. He was the greatest hitter who ever lived, but Joe DiMaggio was a better all-around ball player, and I guess that's what was taken into consideration way back in 1941. But it's interesting, Doc, that you brought up Ted Williams. I have 140 people that I interviewed, all oral histories from all kinds of people, including a couple of 100-year-old people. I have Pumpsy Green in the book, and Jimmy Pearsall.
Whoa.
I got Louis Tiant. I have all kinds of people.
Louis Tiant, wow.
They all wanted to talk about Ted Williams, you know, and I said, I'm not doing a book about Ted Williams. It's really about Fenway Park. And that was difficult, even for me, with my experience, to try to steer them, you know, into another direction. I actually got Jimmy Pearsall on the phone. He's in Chicago now, and the Red Sox, the reason I really did switch allegiance is the Red Sox knew the Yankee background that I brought into doing this book, and yet they were so cooperative, giving me phone numbers and leads and even photos, magnificent photos to use in the book. But I called up Pearsall, and I used what I tell my students to use, the disclaimer, I'll feel to use whatever you give me, and if you tell me it's off the record, of course I won't use it. And he shot back, for crying out loud, I'm 92 years old. Everybody said I was crazy anyway. You could use whatever I say to you. So that was how he started. But he said, I want to start off with Ted Williams. And I said, I want to start off with a fight with you and Billy Martin. You can clear the air.
No kidding. So this was 92?
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm five, right? But maybe 91.
Oh, my God.
You know, what I remember about Billy Pearsall, when he hit his 100th home run as a Met, he ran around the bases backwards.
Why not?
I remember he also, they had a movie done about him. Yeah. And he was
Tony Perkins.
Perkins, I think it was. That's right, from Psycho. Yo, what was it about Ted Harvey that the players wanted to talk about him?
He was just in a real class by himself. I have an incredible story in the book, September 28th, 1960, when Ted Williams hit his final home run of his brilliant career. And I interviewed people who were at the game and also playing in that game, Frank Malzone, a great Red Sox third baseman.
First man to win the Gold Glove, too.
Yeah, he was wonderful in a wonderful interview. And also Brooks Robinson, who was the third baseman for the opposing team, the Orioles, that day, and other people who were in the stands. So that's what the book is about. You're trying to tell the story of the team and the park through those who lived it. And anyway, Williams came close the first couple of times, but he couldn't hit the ball out. The wind got to it, and somebody made a good catch. And in his final try, he hit the home run. And there were only about 10,000 people. It was the last game that season at Fenway Park and the last game of Williams' career. And he went around the bases rounding second, and Brooks Robinson, playing third, said to me that he wanted to say something or slap him on the tush or, you know, tell him congratulations. But he didn't do anything. He just watched as Williams tagged third, and then we headed into the home plate and then went into the dugout. And today, the players would have pushed the guy out for a dozen curtain calls. Gotten that baseball and sent it off to the Hall of Fame. But nobody touched Williams, you know, ever, and he just went into the dugout. Very few, including me, realized that Williams actually went out to play left field in the bottom of that ninth inning, just briefly, and then a substitute was sent in to him, and he ran back to the dugout. When he ran out the home run and crossed home plate, and when he ran back to the dugout, leaving his position in the bottom of the ninth, he did not tip his cap. He didn't even acknowledge the screams and the cheers of the fans. And I didn't also realize that the Red Sox still had three games that September 1960 against the Yankees at Yankee Stadium, and Williams elected, because it was a lost season for the Red Sox anyway, not to go to Yankee Stadium.
He
called it a career. So that was it. That's you asked, you know, what was his appeal? His appeal was, I guess he was like a kind of Frank Sinatra, perhaps, you know, in his own way.
Would you consider him eccentric?
I think he was just possessed by himself.
Oh, he was into himself.
Into himself. He was his own man, but he was a good man. I got stories from people of his supporting the Jimmy Fund, the charity for children's cancer that he talked Tom Yorkey into putting tons of money into, and of his going to visit kids, just as Babe Ruth did. Babe Ruth got the publicity, but Williams visited kids and gave them stuff, and nobody ever even knew about it. So he was a good person in his own right. And Monty Irvin, you mentioned him, Doc. He was great friends with Ted Williams.
Well, I mean, Ted Williams, in his induction speech in the Hall of Fame, said, until you get the black players from the Negro Leagues in the Hall of Fame, the Hall of Fame is not complete. And I heard stories, you know, there was talk that the long delay in the Red Sox getting an African-American player was Yorkie, not Ted. I mean, people forget, you know, Ted spent 5 years in the military, and here we're talking about him. You know, he was a guy who was irate when, after he had spent his initial time in the military, that he had to go back in the Korean War. I mean, here's a guy, 521 home runs. You give him those 5 years, and his Babe Ruth record that he surpasses. He won two triple crowns, lost two in the last day of the season, maybe could have won another one or two. Last guy to hit 400. So, and such a brilliant career, and yet with the 5 years lost, there was a lot of prime years lost. And like I said, you know, Ted said at his induction, until you get the African-American players in here from the Negro Leagues, the Hall of Fame is not complete. A man who didn't get the kind of publicity that he should have gotten, the media didn't give him a fair deal. And you look at, DiMaggio was no more of a personality.
Now, he was a miserable human being. I mean, he freeloaded wherever he could get, you know, anything. In doing
DiMaggio.
And right. Williams did not freeload. That was another thing. You know, DiMaggio never picked up a check in a restaurant and just everything was owed to him.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's a matter of, you know, public record.
Yeah.
Also, he could be very cool and very nasty to people.
Bob Wolf, who was the last five innings of the Larson no-hitter, talked about in his book, you know, when you went to Yankee Stadium and Joseph Paul DiMaggio was there, you didn't know how Joe was going to react. Oddly enough, in my meeting of Mr. DiMaggio and his middle name, ironically enough, all of his brothers and himself had the same middle name, Joseph Paul DiMaggio, and it was because it was his father's favorite saint. Now, George and Joe DiMaggio had a very special relationship. He respected Arthur. He loved Arthur. And I remember Old Timers Day, and Art introduced me to Joe DiMaggio, and Joe went around the side to do an interview with Art, one of the few guys he would talk to. And I remember him coming back and stopping and looking down at me and said, "Hey, it's very nice to meet you." And he liked me. We became friends. But I remember Don Mattingly said what you said, Harvey, and on Old Timers Day, Joseph DiMaggio would not sign autographs. You know, he wouldn't sign balls.
Wow.
Don said, you know, I remember telling Don, he said, he signed something for you? He said he wouldn't sign. And now, Harvey, was there any truth to Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul, the channel Sports and Depth, the show we're talking about, the legendary author and writer, man from Darby, Harvey Farmer, and hello to his lovely wife. Harvey, was there any truth to the proposed trade of the switching? People saying, you know, that left field is unfair to DiMaggio and the right field is unfair to Ted. That there was talk of a trade of switching straight up Ted Williams to the Yankees and Joseph Paul DiMaggio to the Red Sox?
Well, it's been repeated so often in so many books, including mine, that I guess it really did happen. But that was a report back then that both of them were better suited to the other ballpark
of the
rival,
crisis.
And therefore, you know, the trade should have been made. And the punchline to that story was Tom Yorke, and it was also McPhail, or Topping of the Yankees, which version of the story you hear. But one of them called the other right after they allegedly had shook hands after drinking into the wee small hours, and one called the other, and it was the Yankee guy who called. He said, you know, I can't make that deal because that little outfielder that you want me to throw in, we have great plans for him. We were going to make him into a catcher. And that little outfielder, of course, was Yogi Berra.
Yogi Berra. Oh, wow.
Three-time winner of the MVP.
Wow.
Yogi Berra.
Very interesting.
Nelson Jr.
is indeed with you.
Okay,
speaking
we got to that Jerry Harvey Farmer, who's just written his latest book about Fenway Park. He's done 47-odd books. He did the
41.
Actually,
I'm up around 47 when you count the 5 oral histories that I did with my wife, Myrna. So that brings me up to 46, and I have 3 ghostwritten books, too, so that pushes me to 49.
Give us the title of some of the other books, Harvey.
The oral histories are It Happened in Brooklyn, It Happened in the Catskills, It Happened on Broadway, It Happened in Manhattan, and Growing Up Jewish in America. Big 5.
Let's go back. Now, where are you originally from, Harvey?
I'm from Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. High school, college?
I went to Boys High. And then
Boys High?
Wow.
Boys High,
wow.
And then
the
I
an institution.
Yeah, and I grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. It was a tough neighborhood then. Now it's all gentrified.
As a person who lives in Williamsburg, first of all, pleasure to speak to Harvey on the distinguished panel. And Harvey, I would also love to say you grew up in the garden spot of the world, Brooklyn, USA.
Well, I learned to be tough, I learned to fight, and I learned to work hard. So it was really worth something. But I used to come home with books, and I used to get taunted and teased by the guys around there. My father had been a boxer, a club fighter, and he used to club me around, and I used to club him around. And I had 13 fights as a kid also.
Wow, really?
And I got knocked. My nose got broken in the 13th fight. That was the end of it, the unlucky number. Anyway, I concentrated on my books, and I went on to get a master's and a PhD at NYU.
Wow.
And so then I got into college teaching. But sports has always been my great love in terms of an avocation. And I remember, you know, making me nostalgic now, I was privileged enough to grow up in an era when I could listen to the radio and hear the voice of Mel Allen or the voice of Red Barber or the voice of Ernie Harwell. And
Ernie
that
Harwell.
Really made me into a baseball fan.
Right. The great line that
Art Rust always said, you know, he saw it on the radio. And
he saw it on the radio, right.
And boys high school, 13 fights, then you mess. Then you've also done some Ivy League college work, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm a professor at Dartmouth College.
Okay.
Dartmouth.
I remember
I've been up here. I'm speaking to you from the mountains of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
High up, about 2,000 feet up, we're about 10 miles north of Dartmouth College, which is in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Right.
But what I wanted to get to on the show, I thought about this, Fenway Park tryout in 1945.
I was going to talk about that, which led to that book that Art Russ
Get That
wrote,
Nigger Off the Field.
Get That Nigger Off the Field. Harvey, tell us about that.
I just want to get back to Ted Williams for a second, if I can. There's a folk
rolling. Tell you what we're going to do. Let's take a quick break. You can get back to Ted Williams when he can talk about that situation. Fox 10 Sports on the Blake Rainbow Soul Sports Network show. Let's take a quick break. The distinguished, the incomparable Harvey Farmers. With it on anybody move, don't say a word. Sports in depth. Take a quick break.
All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
We have the foremost author of baseball journalism, a author of only 47 books, a man who has skipped allegiances, but luckily he was a Yankee fan before he did that great Yankee book, and he's got his book. Now, remember Fenway Park, but Dusty wants to remember the guy. He's going to talk to Harvey a quick second, then we're going to get back to Harvey wanted to
Harvey.
Talk about. But once again, the Splendid Splitter, Theodore Wilson. Theodore Wayne. Go ahead, Dusty.
Harvey, this is a folklorian story that I heard when I was a teenager, when Ted Williams was retiring, and the reason that I heard this is because this something similar happened when Gil Hodges was a manager of the Mets in 1969 when they won the World Series. This is the story that Ted Williams is such a sharp hitter. He knew what angle he would hit the ball, where he would hit the ball. He would follow the ball, the trajectory of the ball, to the bat, and he knew exactly where he was going to hit the ball to knock it out of the park. The guy said, "Nah, it's impossible. You just don't know where you're going to hit the ball. You just hit it at the meat of the bat, and it's gone." So he said, "You think I cannot do that?" He actually put a smudgering of shoe polish on the ball, and this is the story how I heard. And he followed the rotation, and he hit the ball. He says, "You think I don't?" And the ball was retrieved. And you think I didn't know what I was going to hit? I hit it on the shoe polish, and sure enough, the bat had shoe polish stains on the, you know. And I'm saying, "Whoa, that's how could that be?" Now was that a true story, or was that just a fable that I heard some other guys talk about? Because the reason I mentioned 1969 was because I think Cleon Jones or one of the guys fouled a ball on his foot, and the referee called a strike. I mean, called him out on the third strike, and Gil Hodges came out and says, "No, he fouled the ball on his foot." And he picked up the ball and showed him the umpire, the shoe polish from his shoe, and that's when the story about Ted Williams used a shoe polish trick when he was a ball player. Is that true, or this is a fable?
Cleon Jones thing did happen, the Ted Williams is like the trade of Williams to DiMaggio. You know, we weren't there, so we don't know. But what I did have in the book, and I got this from a couple of people, is that not only did Ted Williams have the greatest eyes, but he also had the greatest feel for weight. And one day in the 50s, this story was told to me by Bobby Doerr, and it was also confirmed by Dom DiMaggio. Williams came out, and he said that the plate was positioned improperly. It was off. And he got into a big argument with Joe Cronin, who was then his manager. And he said, "We can't do anything about it." Now he said, "But, you know, they measure it." He said, "I could tell with my eyes that it's off." The next day, he went out and they measured, and Williams was correct.
Wow.
So he had such an incredible eye that he could tell with a fraction of an inch about the plate not being positioned properly.
Right.
But he also ordered United States postal scales for the clubhouse. So when the Louisville Sluggers came in and they were supposed to be for his weight, he would re-weigh them. And if he found, cause he would hold them in his hand, and if he felt they were off, he would weigh them. And he found times when they didn't measure, they didn't weigh a bat properly. So he was an extraordinary character. But let me get back to Pumpsy Green and get back to that tryout.
Just before you do that, Harvey, wasn't William, speaking of his extraordinary vision, wasn't he a fighter pilot during the war?
He was, yeah, jet pilot.
Jet pilot,
incredible.
In fact, I believe he had a crasher, too. We're getting to the point now. Harvey's going to talk about that famous Elijah Pumpsy Green, Red Sox 1959, get the last African-American player in baseball.
Right.
Harvey, the platform's yours.
Okay, we can spin it off Ted Williams. In 1959, the Red Sox were the last team, as you guys know, to have an African-American player, Pumpsy Green.
Right.
I interviewed Pumpsy Green for the book. He even didn't want to be interviewed. He said he told the story so many times, and then I used my trick. I'll ask you different questions. Then he responded, "Okay, let's see if they're different." I said, "I heard that Ted Williams was unpleasant to you." And he got angry. He said, "Are you kidding? He welcomed me with open arms. He was the one that made me feel comfortable. And Mr. Yorkie, he made me feel comfortable too." So that's what I do sometimes when I do my interviewing. I go the wrong way and I get them to respond. Anyway, we flash, and he, with all due respect to Pumpsy Green, the first black player on the Red Sox and the last black player to break the color line in baseball, he was not the most talented of players. So wonders back now, why did they pick him when they could have in 1945? Jackie Robinson tried out at Fenway Park, Sam Jethro tried out, and Marvin Williams tried out. And also the word was out that Willie Mays was available to the Red Sox. None of them was signed, and they had this tryout. And that was the one where Art Russ Jr. Coined the title for his book, Get That Nigger Off the Field, because in addition to the tryout, which Jackie Robinson later called a sham tryout, somebody in the stands screamed those terrible words to those three players.
Yeah, from one of the, because the officers were inside the ballpark. Somebody from one of the officers probably screamed out.
Somebody in a position of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when Tom Yawkey, who has gone down in history as a benevolent owner, which he was, he would take a batting practice or hit fungos and give the local kids a $20 bill, you know, for shagging flies, or if a guy pitched a no-hitter or did something extraordinary on the field, he'd have that contract ripped up and give him a new contract. So he had that part of him. But they ask him, how come these three black players, you need talent, is during the war you could assign these guys? He said, I don't make the baseball decisions around here. So people talk about the curse of the Bambino, Babe Ruth being sold to the Yankees to change the course of baseball history. I also talk about the curse of Tom Yawkey, because had Tom Yawkey tapped in to the black talent that the Yankees also, they came late to the table too, 1955 with Elston Howard.
Elston Howard, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But had he tapped in 1945, the whole fate of baseball at Fenway Park and the Red Sox would have changed. The Dodgers were there quickly. The Giants were there quickly. Cleveland got there quickly. The White Sox.
Dobie.
Right. But the Red Sox with Pumpsy Green, who became a New York Met, ironically enough.
Right. Wow. And a guy, as you said, Harvey, Doc Stanley, Sports Jeff on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Souls and Sports Jeff the Show, legendary author Harvey Farmer, Dot Mizone is with us. And you talked to a great point, because I mean, Elijah wasn't a talented player, but you're Boston, you're Fenway Park. Talk too about the Curse of the Babe. I mean, the big thing behind that was at the time the owner was a big show guy. The money that he got for the Babe was to help fund a Broadway show, if I'm correct.
That also could be a myth, because you know he really didn't need the money. He had two successes in a row. But it's gone down through history. I may even have perpetuated it in some of my books. We'll never know why he sold the Babe, except that he did not like the Babe and he didn't get along well with him and had a chance to make some more money. But he had enough money to basically get along. But they picked up the mortgage on the ballpark also, the Yankees. Anyway, Babe did not want to leave. He was happy in Boston. This was 1923 Yankee Stadium opened.
Wow, isn't that something?
1912 Fenway Park opened. So the Yankees were really playing in the Polo Grounds as the guests, more or less, or the tenants of the New York Giants. And the Giants, once they saw that Babe Ruth came on the scene and became like a Pied Piper pulling in all this attendance, they told the Yankees, find another place. That's what resulted in Yankee Stadium being built just across the river.
Yeah.
And it was like
it was
in your face, you know, by Rupert to the Giants, you know, we're staying here. And John McGraw screamed out, they're going up to Goatville. Nobody ever goes to the Bronx, you know, they'll never be heard of again. Famous last words.
You talk about McGraw. McGraw was a guy, they said, when he died, he had a list of all the black players had baseball integrated that he would have taken. Harvey, you can't talk about Boston.
There allegedly were black players, though, before Jackie Robinson in baseball, nobody go back and prove unless we go through DNAs or whatever it is.
Right.
Allegedly, they were Cuban or Spanish.
I was just
going to
say the Cubans, There were Latin guys who passed for black so that they can get into the league. They had come over from the other countries.
Yeah.
I mean, from Cuba, I mean.
Yeah.
Harvey.
Go ahead, Harvey.
I was going to say, you do a book about Fenway Park, and you got to talk about the guy who was the guy who sort of replaced Ted Williams, became one of the great players, the last man. You know, you look at Fenway Park. Fenway Park had the player to hit the last 400 hitter, and you had the last man to win a Triple Crown, the great Carl Yastrzemski.
Right. He was not a pleasant personality from what I've heard from people who knew him well, media people, teammates, etc. He was like Tom Yawkey's son, and he knew it. And he was like the best player on that team, and he had a director's chair in the clubhouse. On one side was a place for his ashtray, On the other side was a place for his wine bottle and his glass of wine that he would have, and he would sit there in his kind of throne chair. And media people told me that if he had a bad day, he'd look out. And even if he had a good day, he'd look out, because if you didn't want to talk to him, he didn't know you, you know, that was it. I couldn't get him to be interviewed for this book, despite the fact that the Red Sox, you know, gave me his number and told me to use their offices, et cetera, et cetera. But he was a great player, but not at the level of Ted Williams. The irony of irony is that back to the 1960s story that I told about Ted Williams' last home run.
Right.
The word after that last home run and the word after Williams was done was that next year, 1961, the new Ted Williams would be coming. And that new Ted Williams was called
Yastrzemski.
He had his great run, and then Jim Rice came along, and he had his great run. And I don't know if you consider Manny Ramirez another one in that, you know, mold of outfield
that
just
came
along.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they had a lot of talent, but for many of those years, the Red Sox just couldn't win until 2004, 86 years to break that alleged curse of the Bambino. When they finally did, they did another one in 2007, and the ballpark, which is really one of the miracles of baseball in my mind, Yankee Stadium, the old Yankee Stadium, in my opinion, should still be standing. I don't believe
Exactly.
Knock it down except greed.
Ari, let me ask you something, if I may. Mel Smith Jr., because I'm trying to get your opinion on this. What is it about a lot of the Boston greats, ballplayer-wise, that they seem to have this adversarial relationship with the press?
Because the press in Boston historically has been carping, negative, cynical, unfriendly, looking, you know, out to run players into the ground. I think it's changed today, but back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, there was tremendous animosity. I guess you could say the same thing for the New York press. There are plenty of New York media that looking, you know, to try to get a scoop or a scandal anywhere they can. But it's always been much worse in Boston, and they have fought back, basically. Reggie Smith was treated, you know, badly, and I don't think it was because he was an African-American. It's just that sometimes he didn't hit the way the press wanted him to hit or behave the way, whatever it was. So they really get on players, but I don't think it was racial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Reggie Smith, ironically, Reggie Smith was part of that Dodger team. The only team in baseball history to have well, they're the only team to have four guys to hit over 30 home runs in one season. Reggie was in the right field, Steve Garvey at first base, the Penguin, Ron Sayers at third base, and I think the most popular manager in baseball and the best right now, Dusty Baker, who was the last guy to pop home run number 30, was in left field. So all the corners hit 30 home runs, right field, left field, third base, first base. Yastrzemski, you look to now Manny Ramirez, Pedro Martinez. The you have a high influx of Latin players who have seemed to go to Boston and do well. Is that an acceptance thing in Boston where they maybe more open arms to Latin players than they were to African American players, Harvey?
Well, they've had black players through the years who also done, you know, George Scott played there.
George Scott, yes, first base.
He was, you know.
Bo Vaughn.
Bo Vaughn played there. They have plenty. Oil Can Boyd, who I interviewed.
Oil Can Boyd, what a character.
He's a character. He's still pitching. Oil Can Boyd. He's still pitching somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Jim Rice.
And Jim Rice, we can't leave him out.
The mold of begotten great left fielders, Theodore. Yes, Rice, and then Manny. You know, Rice is the only guy outside of Lou Gehrig to have a 3-year run of 40 home runs, 300 batting average, 200 hits, 100 RBIs, 100 scored runs, 20 doubles, 15 triples. You know, looking at it, you know, here's a guy who had the most home runs and RBIs of his era, and yet it took him 15 years to get into the Hall of Fame. But without question, one of the great Boston players there, Harvey.
I agree, but I also think, going back to your earlier question, about Ted Williams not getting that MVP award twice when players who had inferior seasons to him. It's also, you know, it's not only who you know, it's but who you ingratiate to you or who you turn off. And it's unfair, but that's really the way it works. And Rice was a sullen player to many of the media that he came into contact with, and it didn't help him out in the Hall of Fame voting. It shouldn't be that way, but, you know, that's the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Looking back at go ahead, Dusty.
No, I was just going to ask again, can you talk to us about the tenure of Louis Tiant when I think Boston had him for a while, and then surprisingly the rival down the river got him, Louis Tiant. Can you highlight that as to why this happened?
And not only that, Javier, I mean, you're looking at that situation. You know, this, I mean, people don't understand. You talk the most serious rivalry in baseball, Dodgers and the Giants, but the Yankees and the Red Sox have one that's very well known. And you look, as Dusty
like
has brought up, Doc Stanley
Sports Chef
on the Blake Reader Note, Rainbow Soul Sports Network, the show, legendary author and baseball historian, Harvey Farmer's with us. And you look, and Dusty brought a great point. You know, Wade Boggs leaves Boston, comes to the Yankees. Roger Clemens leaves Boston, comes to the Yankees. Louis Tiant leaves Boston, comes to the Yankees. And
Babe Ruth.
Well, then we had Mike Torres left the Yankees.
Right. You had a lot of back and forth. I interviewed Ralph Houk. He left the Yankees. He went to Boston via Detroit.
Left the Yankees. Went to Boston.
Yeah. So many. Sparky Lyle.
Sparky Lyle. Wow, that's a name. Yeah.
So Louis Tiant, one of the most touching bits of oral history that I have in my book, which I didn't realize until I interviewed Louis, is that his father, Louis Tiant Sr., was one of the great pitchers in Cuban baseball history.
But he never
could make the major leagues because of his dark skin. I think they probably thought he was black rather than Cuban. Anyway, he couldn't even get let out of Cuba. Because Castro kept him there.
Yeah.
The mother couldn't get out either. It was our State Department that intervened and got him Louis's mother, to come to the United States.
Exactly.
And they had been separated for quite a while, and the father had taught Louis how to pitch and get him to wind up, et cetera, et cetera. So Louis replayed for me that moment when he was on the mound for the Red Sox. His father and mother were behind home plate in the stands. The father was wearing that little cap that he used to wear when he was tutoring Louis, how to pitch as a kid, and giving him hand signals and body English to try to tell him where to throw the ball. And for Louis, I don't think he even did that well that day, but it was one of those great moments in baseball for him to be reunited with his parents. Unfortunately, they didn't live that much longer
after they
came to the United States. But that was one of the great Fenway Park stories that I really, you know, like to write about. And I also mentioned the Save Fenway Park group. These were ordinary citizens who gave up time from work or teaching or whatever, or being housewives or whatever things that they had, to petition, to picket, to fight. And they were the ones really responsible for the John Henry group coming along and pledging that it would keep Fenway, improve it, make it even better, which it has done. But they put their money where their mouth is. And Fenway is like an American treasure, whereas the old Yankee Stadium belongs just to history.
Exactly.
Fenway is the oldest ballpark, right?
It is the oldest ballpark in American history. It'll be 100 years old next year.
But why is it that Boston has not conformed to a new ballpark? I mean, what is it about Fenway, what is it about the history that's allowed this park to survive in the era of the dome stadiums, of AstroTurf? In your words, what's your
story? I think part of it is the Save Fenway Park Committee. I interviewed Dom DiMaggio. He told me, I was the last one to interview him before he passed. He told me that Tom Yorke, the old owner, promised him that he would have first crack with an ownership group to buy the Red Sox and buy Fenway Park. And Don DiMaggio was bitter when he spoke to me. He said, because Fenway should have been torn down. It's a useless old thing. I said, I'm glad you didn't get the chance to own the team, because I disagree with you. And we got into a little argument on the phone, which I usually don't do. I usually just do my interviewing. But then the Fenway Park Group came along, this tradition in Boston, even more so, I think, than in most cities, of honoring landmarks and honoring old things. And the park, in some ways, is uncomfortable because it was built, you know, for smaller people. And many of the seats are still, you know, cramped. The sight lines are not as great as they could be. You don't have all the modern conveniences. But they now are pushing towards 700 straight sellouts, and it's really a happening place inside and out. And I don't think the same thing can be said about the new Yankee Stadium.
You know, it's funny you talk about the new Yankee Stadium. Doc Stanley sports up on the Blake Rainbow Souls sports up on the show. Mel Smith Jr., you got something to say. You know, people have talked about, my man Buck O'Neill was, when they were talking about tearing down Yankee Stadium or moving, he said, first of all, the Yankees can't move out of the Bronx. You can't take Yankee Stadium out of the Bronx. And it's ironic. I mean, they built a ballpark right across the street. Everybody says the ballpark is not fan-friendly. It's designed now that you can't get to the players. I remember the guy said that the seats he had in the last year, that he paid like $175 behind home plate, well, those same seats were going to go for that same price up in the third deck. So a lot of the history
it's a shopping mall now.
A shopping mall and a dining area.
I got an even better one, though.
Right.
Somebody told me that ballpark looks like it was designed by Mussolini.
Wow.
How's that for a line?
Wow. Oh, my God. This is the first time I heard of that one.
We've been there a couple of times, Dustin, and it just doesn't have the same. I remember the old Yankee Stadium. One of the things about the old Yankee Stadium, they renovated, was that one of the great things about going to the old Yankee Stadium was at the end of the game, you could walk on the field and go out the left field stand.
You'd walk on the field.
I mean, that was for a kid. Man, come on, dude. To walk in any baseball field, but I mean the Yankee Stadium, that was something. Mel Smith Jr., we've been quiet for a while. I know you got to have a question or two for Harvey. He's there for you.
Doug, I just want to say right off the bat that the Sports In-Depth Nation owes you a great deal of gratitude to be able to keep coming up with guests like the great Harvey Farmer. I mean, y'all know how you just do it time after time. You have the greats, you know, on the show. As far as Harvey's concerned, I'm very interested, Harvey, to know exactly how long it took you to research and do the book.
As I told everybody before, I came from Brooklyn, and it was a tough neighborhood then, so I had to move fast. So this took me only 2 years. But I did write Remembering Yankee Stadium before this, so that, in a way, was like a model, and both books are almost 4 pounds, almost 140 inches each, 240 pages, and 100,000 words. So it's not really just a coffee table book. It's a coffee table book with muscles. It's not just another pretty face. And if anyone is interested in getting it, it's a $45 book. But on Amazon, it's a real bargain. It's only $29.70 or something like that.
Well, that is a real bargain. Getting back to Fenway.
Hold on, Doug. You mentioned that a couple of times, too. Harvey, what are the similarities between Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park? What are the differences, as you have written about both ballparks? What did you find very similar, and what did you find so different?
Well, I don't think there's really comparisons aside from the fact that greats have played in both ballparks. They've both been in the American League for as long as anybody can remember, in the same division or in the same place, battling each other through all of these years. And they've also shared, as we pointed out a little while ago, some of the same great players, or managers have come back and forth between them. But they're totally different. Fenway is like an old-time baseball field. It was really wedged in into the middle of the cities, the Fens section of Boston, and so
right.
much now has grown up around it. What they
Excellent.
Call the Green Monster now is once just the Iron Monster. And
right,
when
right.
did that name Green Monster, Harvey?
It was really it was the Iron Monster, and it wasn't painted, and it had ads on it, which is going to, I think, happen again. But Tom Yawkey, first, when he bought the team, there was advertising, and then he didn't want the advertising, so everything was painted green, including the monster, which became the Green Monster. And then the paint company, as the story goes, was going to go out of business, and they worried about getting that green paint, and Yawkey simply bought the paint company, so he had no problem getting the green paint. So that really is the most distinguishing feature of Fenway Park, and then yet now you have the monster seats, people sitting on top of that monster, which people never thought would happen. There's nothing at Yankee Stadium. The facade is there, so I guess that's its most distinguishing characteristic. But there was once Death Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
They have
seen it or heard about it. Yeah, the monuments also were once in the playing
field.
Yeah,
right,
and,
right.
And some
right.
people hit shots out there, and in outfield they had to go running around the monument to try to find. And people thought there were dead bodies. People were buried on those monuments.
Graves.
So that's the distinguishing. But now it's more sterile because it's Monument Park or whatever it is. It's not really. It's way out there somewhere.
Right,
along
yeah.
to the ballpark.
Yeah. Harvey,
how about the statue of Steinbrenner? What do you think of that?
Well, as Don King said, only in America, or only in Yankee Stadium. Harvey, you talked about
yeah.
players, and Dick Raddick was a guy that Mantle said was his the toughest hit a pitcher he had to face. You had Billy Mambuquette. He had Pedro Martinez. He had some great pitches too. Well, Clemens came from there. Did you get a chance to talk to some of those guys or some of the people who knew those guys? And Raddick has passed on, and the Clemens come up. Some of the great pitchers that came out of Boston, you get a chance to talk to them?
I spoke to Bruce Hurst, who was also always one of my favorites, a wonderful mm-hmm. interview, and I rank him among the top ones. Gene Connolly, who was a star in the NBA for the Celtics, and also with the Red Sox, a guy named Boo Ferris. I guess none of you guys ever heard of him. Dave Boo Ferris. Ferris. Yeah, he was a right-handed star in the 40s and 50s. Mel Parnell. He
that
was
name
a great
heard.
Red Sox southpaw pitcher. And then Sparky Lyle,
Sparky
who was
Lyle,
another
right.
Good guy. And of course, I should not leave out Bill Lee.
Bill Lee?
The spaceman.
Wow.
The spaceman.
Bill Lee, yeah. Wonderful character, wonderful man.
Fox Stanley Sports is up on the Blake, but Rainbow Soul is here on Sports Center. The show, Rainbow Soul, is delighted to have a legend in here with us. And, Harvey befriended me way back up at the book signing, and we started talking about Art Russ. And the next thing I know, I had a friend. Harvey,
And also, I must say this about Art Rust. When I was just starting out writing sports books, I got on his radio show a couple of times. He didn't know me from a hole in the wall, and he was cordial, kind, intelligent, and informed. And I got some really nice plugs, which really helped my career along, so I'm always indebted to him.
Art Rust, as Mel Smith Jr. alluded to, not only had the number one sports show on ABC Radio, but we had the number one show, period, and he was delighted and honored when I gave him your book. Gentlemen, I'm going to ask one more question, then you can have him, but we've talked, and I met, people know Jackie was the first player, but there was a lot of talk at one time that your good friend Monty Irvin was the guy that they were fingering to be the first player to break the color line there, Harvey.
And Monty probably had more baseball talent than Jackie Robinson, but Jackie Robinson was college educated, had played in an integrated environment, And Branch Rickey, you know, was a smart judge of talent and of men. Mm-hmm. I figured that Jackie had to be the one. Now, Monty told me he could never have been the one, because if they started doing what they did to Jackie, you know, cursing and giving him what they gave him, he said, I would have taken a bat and busted somebody's head wide open.
Well,
I would have done
Jackie
the same
Robinson
thing.
Also was an officer in the military, wasn't he?
Right, officer.
Yeah, yeah, second lieutenant.
He faced a court-martial trial.
Court-martial,
for standing
nice.
Up for his own rights. He was incredible. My Jackie Robinson story as a kid is a really moving one, if I may be allowed to tell it.
Harvey, you better tell it. You may be
allowed.
Go ahead, Harvey.
My father was a taxi driver in Brooklyn. And in the summertime, when I was out of school and just a young kid, he would take me with him in the cab. Well, it wasn't really allowed, but nobody cared back then. And I used to drive around with him. And we got to Snyder Avenue in Brooklyn, and he said to me, that's where Jackie Robinson lives. And he said, maybe he'll come out. We parked across the street, and this big, big black guy came out, you know, just with a T-shirt and polo pants, and it was Jackie Robinson, and I rushed over, and he was probably either going for a newspaper or a bottle of milk or something, and I told him, Jackie, I'm one of your biggest fans. He said, that's really nice, you know, and I had this very deep voice, and I said, the Dodgers are going to win the pennant this year, and he said to me, if kids like you keep on following us and rooting for us, we're going to win the pennant this year. And
wow,
he put his hand out, and I shook his hand, and my hand got lost in that powerful grip. And that was my Jackie Robinson moment. And then we flash forward years later. I went into Chock Full of Nuts on Fulton Street in downtown Brooklyn. And I'm sure some of your listeners realize that Jackie was like a public relations guy or a goodwill ambassador for
Chocolate. Yeah, he was the vice president of...
Yeah, vice president in terms of making people feel good about Chocolate and Nuts, I think. Anyway, here he now no longer was the young, powerful, you know, black man with a white T-shirt on going out to get on a summer morning. But now he was wearing a suit, had gray hair, had a paunch, and he didn't look too good. And I felt very sorry. I didn't even go over to him because I didn't want to bother him. And he died not too long after that.
Yeah.
Jackie Roosevelt Robinson, four-letter man at UCLA. Duke Snyder, was a big Jackie Robinson admirer, teammate, and follower, told the story of how great Jackie was. He said, Jackie's playing shortstop at the game, UCLA. He comes in, drops his glove down, and starts going toward the outfield. And Duke says, well, Jackie, where are you going? He says, well, I'm going to go forward. He says, this guy at USC is not that good today. So he goes out in between innings and wins the broad jump and comes back and plays. One of the great all-around athletes of the 20th century. And as we know, just went through so much, and there was many times Jackie had considered Hal Jackson, the first African American sportscaster in so many venues, and talked about how Jackie had thought about quitting. Buck Leonard, the great Buck Leonard, considered the Lou Gehrig of African American players, or Lou Gehrig was the Buck Leonard of non-African American players. Had told me personally that Jackie, as you just said, Harvey, was more suited. He said Jackie wasn't the best player in the league, but he was the best guy suited. His interaction with the people of the Caucasian race, being a college educated, being a guy from California, Jackie at the right age with the right temperament where he wouldn't be a young guy to fly off at the handle, and he wasn't too old. As you had just said, Buckland had concurred, Jackie Robinson was the perfect guy to do what he did to change the course of history and baseball and sports in America. Doc Stanley, Sports and Death on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul Channel Sports Network, the show. We're looking for another writer to join in, but right now we will continue to digest, dissect, and enjoy the one and only Harvey Farmer.
Only for a couple of more minutes, because believe it or not,
problem,
I have another
Harvey
radio interview coming up.
Okay.
But we could do a double header. Let's try to reschedule soon, and I'll come on again.
Harvey.
Okay. We have to come on again.
Okay, Harvey, before you leave, then, thoughts and what do you want to say? Where can we get the book? And what's the final word that you want to leave with us today, Harvey?
My final word is that it's really nice to be able to talk sports, talk baseball, basketball, and I think it's so much better just to give my own humane point of view that play ball instead of kill people.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tremendous. You know, getting back just a few minutes, what I wanted to mention before, you mentioned the Green Monster. Is that one of the reasons why Fenway will remain Fenway without any change? Because I've ever since I can remember baseball, I can remember just hearing about the Green Monster, the Green Monster, the Green Monster. The question is that why it will remain the same? Because it looks like a homegrown, old-fashioned, made-for-baseball park.
I
hate for it to be changed and like they did with the Yankee Stadium and things like that.
I agree with you perfectly on that point. It's an American treasure, you know, really something
that
harkens back to another time. And it's really great to have it around, and they've done so many wonderful things making it better than it ever was. And it's a disposable society, as all of us agreed, there really was no reason to take down Yankee Stadium except for
Harvey, you hit it right on the head, Harvey. And Fenway Park validates that fact, Harvey. It validates
fact.
Exactly.
Sure. They crank in 37,000. If you start adding up the stats for the Yankees, are they pulling 37,000 for every game? I don't think so.
No. It's a losing enterprise.
I know.
I mean, in senses, you know. There was a remark the other day by one of the announcers that said that the Yankees should play all the teams, National and American League, because they're such a franchise that they sell out the places wherever they go, especially Boston, of course.
Right.
But what when they're home,
they don't
sell out they don't sell out their place. You know, they don't make they're not getting the bang for the buck, so to speak, because of the new stadium. And the old stadium should have prevailed. It should have left it there. I mean, I don't see why they make a mistake. But I love Fenway because of the fact that it's an old-fashioned community ballpark.
It's part of everybody's common history. You don't have to be a Red Sox fan to love my book or to love Fenway.
Exactly. You can
those
see,
are my final words, though, guys.
Hey,
I've got to go.
Harvey, thank you is really not enough to say. We'll get
thank
you back,
much.
My friend.
God
thanks
bless,
so much.
Man.
Regards to the lovely wife. Love you, my friend, and thanks so much for being with
us. Love you, too.
Take care.
Bye.
Thank you very much.
The greatest baseball writer of our time and generation just had a time to stop and talk. I mean, you know the thing about Harvey, the education that just came with that. And once again, the great line. And Mel, I want to thank you for always being that gracious guy who thanks and brings in our guest to Sports and Definition, which is your line. We're looking for John Hurt.
Well, thank you, Doctor.
As we continue
doctor,
to
I
that.
I just wanted to say this, if I may. You know, Doctor, it was a great, and thanks again, Doc, for all your accolades. It's always a pleasure, you know, being part of the crew here.
I understand when you guys are not sitting at the table. You're bringing something to the table. And it's just, I can sit here and know that maybe on the day that my fastball ain't working, I can throw a curveball because you'll catch it at third base. Dusty's going to pull it down at first base. And that if I double the right field.
I always say about Dusty and our esteemed panel here that the sports in-depth nation around the globe should know, as I always say, when you hear us, it means big things popping, little things stopping.
It's a wealth of information from this gentleman, and I'm amazed that I can sit here and listen.
Rainbow Soul, the show. Is it John? Is you?
That's me.
Ladies and gentlemen, right on time, Dusty and Mel Smith Jr., John D. Hurt. You know, you never know who you're going to run into. You know that
doing,
great
John?
Line. You never get a second chance to make a first impression. We're up in Harlem. Leroy Neiman is up there at his school that he's done so much for. And this guy comes over to Leroy Neiman, gentlemen, and he gives Leroy, he says, I've got some of your books. I want you to have one of mine. And well-dressed with his lovely wife. And then he turns and says, "Hey, you know, I talked to hey, Doc, you know, best wishes, Johnny Hirsch." And I said, "Well, look, is it possible we can get you on the show?" And he says, "Well, sure." He called me early, wanted to talk about, gentlemen. He's got a book here. All the joints are pencil. We've got another artist, another author, and Dusty, you can start the questioning. First of all, John, before we even go, let's just background. Where are you from? How are you started, John?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Born and raised in Trenton, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Live in Long Island now with my wife Nancy. And
lovely Nancy.
Thank you very much. Have been in the art world for about 5 years. On my 58th birthday, Nancy said to me, "Get in the car. I'm going to take you to get you a present." And she took me over to an art store and said, "Buy whatever you like." I never knew that I really had talent in drawing. I just liked to draw and never did much of it. And from that day on, that really changed my life significantly, because all of a sudden, things started to come out of my hand that had never been there before. And it has become a passion. It's the most passionate thing I've ever had other than my relationship.
Now, so you're telling me that, okay, I got some static there. Dusty, you a little Coco, so I got to get that deleted, whatever you're doing. Get that away from the microphone, please. John,
give me some static here, Doc.
Yeah, okay. John.
Yes, sir.
So you're saying that this is like, boom. It just, your wife said, "Go for it," and it just happened all of a sudden.
Absolutely. I always was into photography, and I used to draw, and I used to, you know, doodle around with a pencil, but never took it seriously and was never told I had talent, never told to take lessons or anything like that. And she just decided, and truthfully, we've discussed it many times, you know, why she went and why she decided to take me to an art store and say, "Buy pencils and buy what you need to do some drawing." And my life literally changed, and that's a little better than 5 years ago now.
Wow, isn't that something?
You have any kids, John? Sure.
I have a son that lives in Tampa, Florida. His name is Devin, and he's also an artist. And
he was an artist before you were an artist, huh?
Exactly. He's actually in the graphic design, you know, the new world with the computers.
Right.
But you never went to these schools, art instructions that advertise, "Draw me and get a scholarship" or something? No, no,
no.
The reason I'm asking you that, because my sister's an artist.
Oh.
And she had seen this advertisement, I think when she was 10 or 11 years of age. And finally, my pop was able to afford the loose change to set it to art instruction. And she's an artist now. And this is when you talk about art, I mean, this is relative to me, because my sister paints a landscape, portrait painting and watercolor. And she's had half a dozen exhibits and all that. And now she's taking, oh, my God, I can't remember the course where you put things on a T-shirt. What do you call that? Oh God, I forgot the scientific name for it, but you sound just like her, because she does all the sketching and painting and in fact she's into the greeting card business greeting cards on her own, you know, and I'm saying that takes a heck of a talent, you know. I've tried to do that. Are you kidding? There's no way I can
get a straight line even with a ruler. John, looking at your book, the brochure here, you have a horde of pictures. Now, these pictures, are they photos, because you penciled them, are they photos from just the eastern region, or are they from across the world, scanning the globe?
Well, most of the drawings that you see in that book, many of them are from street people of New York City. Some are from the Bahamas. Some are from the Bahamas. Yes, I've gone to the Bahamas a few times. Actually, when I started to draw for the first 10 months, since I'm not trained at all and I have had no lessons in drawing.
Trained, but you're darn sure talented.
Thank you very much.
It's a natural talent.
And I was, for 10 months, I just was taking photographs off the internet. and just drawing them. And about 10 months into it, we happened to be in the Bahamas, and I met a gentleman named Mr. Herman Higgs, who was the first drawing you'll see in the book. And Mr. Higgs was a fishing guide in the Bahamas, and I asked him if I could take his photograph, and I did. And when I came home, I was so fascinated by his look that
right.
I started to draw his portrait, and that changed my life completely. Then I started
right.
to realize that portraits and anything that could really elicit an emotion in me is what
right.
I really wanted to draw. So when you look at my drawings and my work, you will see that most of them will elicit an emotion in the viewer, and that's what I really go after. I look for things that move me, whether it be in still life or
right.
nostalgia, something that's going to, you know, move me and the viewer.
John Mosmith Jr. here, pleasure to have you on.
I have to tell you,
I have always been as someone who can barely draw a smiley face, I can tell you that I've always been truly fascinated by
exactly.
artists. Truly fascinated
Absolutely.
By, but really, I can barely draw a smiley face. My question is, I have to tell you, and I'm always uniquely fascinated by true artists like yourself.
Thank
and
you.
Believe it or not, the guys who draw for like the news and you know, draw the people on trial, and
absolutely.
You know, you can't take the official cameras in, but you can get an
right.
artist sketch, an artist rendering. And
yeah.
the likeness is so much, John, that I'm fascinated. Just like the police artists who will draw the suspect
yeah.
from a description, and when they bring the guy in, it's a split image of him. And to me, that's just
exactly.
fascinating.
Right.
It is interesting, and it's... you know, faces are what really move me. I happen to be in the city yesterday walking through Battery Park, and when I see somebody's face that just gets me, or an outfit
right.
or something like that, I light up, because then I see what I want to draw. And,
well, John, as a great artist yourself, let me ask you this. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
As a great artist yourself, let me ask you this. They have these guys, but I haven't been here in some time, but They would have the guys, and I'd walk on around 47th and 7th or 8th, who
mm-hmm.
would draw your sketch, have you sit down,
oh,
take about
break, yeah.
15 minutes, yeah, to draw your sketch.
Right.
A sketch of you where you're just, you know, where you're posing and sitting down. And I got to say, looking at their work, to the untrained eye like mine, looks a lot like the people they're drawing. I mean, it's a blatant image.
They're
and
very,
I want to know if you ever passed those guys and said, you know, good stuff.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I see these artists on the street that do these charcoals in 15 minutes,
yes,
20 minutes,
yeah.
and they amaze me because they are very, very good. My drawings, if you notice, most of them are very, very large. They're 30 by 40. I use boards
wow.
to draw on, and they literally can take me between 80 and 200 hours to draw.
Wow.
So you must be very detailed in your approach. John.
I am very,
very
detailed. Very detailed. Most people think I'm an extremely patient person, which is
right.
the furthest thing from the truth. But when it comes to art and when it comes to drawing, I am very, very patient. It's,
well, let me ask you this. When you get an idea, you say you were in Battery Park yesterday or whatever,
yes.
and you saw this person, and you do you like sketch the person on a little pad, and
no.
then when you go home, you go onto the canvas?
No, actually, what I do is I will approach a person,
right.
tell them that I'm an artist. My camera is my sketch pad. Sketch pad. So I
right.
walked up to this gentleman yesterday,
mm-hmm.
Told him that I was an artist, and asked him his permission to
I
take
see,
his photograph.
I see what you mean.
He
right.
was glad to let me take
mm-hmm.
the photograph, and I have a camera that rapid fires, so within literally 2 to 3 minutes, I had
uh-huh.
50 shots of this gentleman. And
wow.
I come home, and then I look through them, go through them,
mm-hmm.
use 2 or 3 of them to get the drawing
yeah.
that I want.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start to sketch it and, you know, work
yeah.
it out, and it takes me hours to actually lay
right.
out the drawing.
It must have been, I remember, really the light to be in the company of the legendary Leroy Neiman. I mean,
oh.
you know, here's a guy who
oh, yeah.
he, you know, every athlete wants to
have in their den someplace a Leroy Neiman reprint. That's funny because I know there's one fighter, I won't mention him, and Leroy loves boxing. That's his passion. And we were talking one day, and he says, Mel, you know, he's the one guy that I've never had a desire to draw. But the fair, you know, in the company of an artist like Leroy Neiman, it's definitely inspiration as well as admiration there, John.
I was in awe. I have to tell you, we got there. You know, when you drive into New York City from Long Island, you're never on time. You're either late or you're early. And luckily this time, I was early. And Mr. Neiman was there, and I got the pleasure of getting to spend around 10 to 15 minutes.
Ironically, you know, he was not supposed to be there.
Exactly.
I first got the invitation, Lynn, when I was in Brazil. And she said, you know, Mel, Leroy is invited to this thing, but, you know, me and Janet are going to be there. Most likely Leroy will not be there because when I got there, I was a little surprised to see Leroy there. So he was originally not going to be there. But luckily for us, thank God, he was there, John.
I'm
sorry to cut you off.
I was in such awe, and I was able to speak to him for about 10 to 15 minutes. And when Nancy, my wife, gave him my book to look at, and was because I was telling him I was an artist, and he started to look at my work. And when he started to compliment me, I didn't even know what to say. I think I turned 12 shades of red because I was, I was so embarrassed by the great, one of the greatest artists ever, telling me that my work was great. You know,
John, I'm glad that you said that because I wanted to know when it came to, as you said, your meeting with Leroy Neiman. Is that sort of on the par of a current great in yourself finally meeting a legend at what you do? Is it sort of like the great meeting I compare a great ball player
it's like
great
like
star
Derek G.D.B. Banks.
Meeting a Hall of Famer.
Sure,
absolutely. Derek G.D.B. Nerney Banks, anybody, you know, meeting the Willie Mays, it's just the idol and the adulation of meeting somebody that you sort of admired from afar, you've seen on stage and screen, and now they're right there. You know, you remind me
absolutely
of that you said it, John. I remember the first time I had met Willie Mays at a press conference, but I was at a fair, and the greatest player that ever lived, my favorite player. I mean,
my all-time favorite also,
oh, he's
by the way.
and I remember telling Julius one time after me and Julius became close, and I said, you know, Julius, I love you. You know, man, he said, Mel, he said, you know you don't love nobody better than Willie. And
right.
I remember when Willie, we were at the Hall of Fame affair, and he was, hey, man, sit up here, man. He said, hey, man, give me one of your cards. I'm saying, like, Willie Mays is asking for my card?
Wow.
I said, Willie Mays, sit down, man, relax, man. Willie Mays is asking, and I know Doc Stanley, Sports and Depth on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Souls, here, Sports and Depth, the show, authors, artists, and people with extraordinary talent. And John D. Hertz continues as he passed the baton from Harvey over to him. The Sino Baby Lost My Co-host, along with little Mel Smith, Kel Jr., WF Star. We've got him cornered. Looney's got him pinned down. We're talking, and we're learning a lot about. Now, John, you were talking about the meeting of Leroy Neiman. Have you ever met other artists that you've admired of renown?
Not of that stature, no. No.
Okay. Well, again,
I've met many other artists that I think are phenomenal artists,
well,
but
such as,
none of that
stature. Give us a name.
I know a gentleman in the Bahamas named Kim Smith. He's not a well-known artist, but he is a marvelous artist. I really have not met that many famous artists.
Let me ask you this. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have to ask you this, John, since you mentioned it. Being one of the current greats yourself, what do you think of the late, great Bill Gallo's work?
I know it. I am not. I will tell you this. I am not an art historian. I do not know much. Like I said, this is so new to me. This is everything is so new. So I'm starting to learn about artists myself. I'm starting now to go on the internet and buying books about artists because Norman Rockwell is one of my favorites.
Wow.
He's always been one of my favorite artists. I just love the work he has done in the past. I like the scenes, the Americana. I like the people, and you can see in my work, that's what I love to do. I am starting to do more and more scenes. I'm trying to develop my type of work, so where I can do more of scenes of people in their settings, different things like that.
Good point, and bringing up Bill Gallo, as your point well taken. I've got Big C, graphic designer. Charlie, we got you here. We've got John D. Hertz, a guy who said he just started doing it, graphic designer. Some thoughts and questions to John, Big C. I know because we got you running on a space limit, too. Questions for John.
Hi, John. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to hear your voice again.
Thank you.
I'm a graphic designer, so I'm on the other end of what you guys do. So you're an illustrator?
People have called me an illustrator. I just like to say that I'm an artist and I draw. I don't really have a I may be called a realist.
Okay.
And that representational art. There's
all right.
Many names to it. I just find that, that I try to bring out the emotion, the realism of a face, a subject that I'm working on. So I don't really have a name for what I do. People have told me that I'm a realist, that I'm a, representational artist. So, they've put names on it.
Right.
Because you have people who... Like Tony Bennett, it's an artist. He's an artist. He only started that a few years ago, and
he happens to be a wonderful artist.
It's been a while. I mean, it was actually Tony went to school to become an artist. Tony was his art being an artist was always his love. I mean, he went to one of the local high schools for drawing.
Right.
It was something that he always loved. Fellas on Dusty and. Little Mel, we're going to let Charlie interject because he's got a time frame too. Now, Tony Bennett, Tony Bennett was first. Bob Hope was the one that gave him the name Tony Bennett. They were at an affair one night, and Bob Hope, Benedict said, no. You know what, ladies and gentlemen, Tony Bennett, and talking to Mr. Bennett up at the JVC Jazz Festival. Up in Saratoga, and the fact they had some of his work, I wish I had grabbed something then. But he did confer that it was Pearl Burley that discovered him, and I found out in the ensuing years that it was Bob Hope who told him, "Hey, you know what? That Benedict, no, that's out." Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, Mr. Tony Bennett, it was Bob Hope who first. Little Anthony of the Imperials. It was a DJ. He was Anthony the Imperials, and he played. He said, "No, it's Little Anthony." And so it's amazing how some of these names come about. But Tony always had a love for art and wanted to be an artist. And he went to school. He went to school to become an artist. One of the local high schools. He's always been gifted and always has been pointed in that direction.
Yeah.
As we know, he became a singer. Gentlemen, don't nobody move. We're going to do the commercial break. And then Big C is going to lead the question one more time as we have John D. in the house. Don't anybody move. Dusty, don't say another word.
All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Broadcasting to the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Okay, Doc Stanley, Sports Day, ladies, scribing sports. Doc Stanley hosts his round radio show, Sports in Depth. Stanley has sports posse. Once again, ride the ever-changing, controversial terrain and unstable plains of sports. The show features special guest Harvey Farmer, author of Remembering Fenway Park, John D. Hertz, artist and designer, and we're also looking for Ryan T. Bloch to join us as well as Amelia. But we've got John D. in the house. Big C, he's yours one more time.
Appreciate it. So you said, you like to express like the emotions of a face. So where do you draw your inspirations from?
It's very, very interesting. When I drew Mr. Higgs, who was my first real subject that got me into the portraits, I realized, looking at it, that faces and I never actually looked at people the way I look at them today. I look at them now, and my whole life changed because of this. because now I look at people in a totally different way, whether they're homeless. If they're homeless, I feel for them much more than I did years ago. I just realized that these are situations these people are in, and I've been blessed to have drawn some of the homeless and then actually see them afterwards and present them with like an 8x10 copy of something that I've done.
Wow.
And it's been an amazing change in my life to understand what these people or some of these people are going through. Even the people that are not homeless that I just find truly fascinating faces. I've been very, very lucky. I was commissioned to do a couple drawings for the Urban Bush Women, if you're familiar with them. They are dancers, a dance group out of Brooklyn that's been dancing for 25 years and for their 25th anniversary that was held at the Harlem stage. They asked me to do the commission of the founder and the artistic director, and I was commissioned to do their portraits. It was a marvelous, marvelous experience, and to see these faces and the dance moves, and I was able to go in at another time and photograph them as they were practicing, and it's just been very, very interesting for me. I don't know where I draw my inspiration from. It just comes from inside, really. And when I'm out there and I see a face, I know it. I know it. That's got to be my next subject, and I
want to put it on. You want to put it on canvas.
Exactly. Exactly.
Let me ask you something about the homeless or the down. I shouldn't say the downtrodden, but I mean people who are less fortunate than us. Do when you show them, when you photograph them and paint them and all that, do you find them to be receptive?
Very much
because
so.
Because they're seeing for lack of a better word, they're seeing their misery on canvas.
Well,
and you wonder
I don't really want to have misery. That's not what I try to portray.
Right.
If you look at my drawings, and you will see, I try to portray the soul of the person.
I see.
That's
mm-hmm.
what it. That's what I find interesting. And when you do, there happens to be a drawing that I did. It's called One Leg Willie, and that's what he told me his name was. This man was in a wheelchair.
Oh.
He has one leg. Very famous around New York. He used to hang out at Penn Station asking for, handouts. And,
mm-hmm.
and I came over to him, and I had given him some money for posing for me. And then when I came back and I saw this man maybe 6 months after I had done the drawing, he was on the same corner down in Chelsea. And I saw him, and I walked over to him, and he could barely lift his head. And when I showed him the drawing that I did of him, he smiled from ear to ear. And what I found is that people just want to be recognized. They want to, they want to be that somebody cares about them.
Yeah.
And noticed. And that's what it is.
Right.
And I take the time.
It's like a picture. You know, a picture is forever. It puts you in the same position and place and time. And it's, like you say, it's therapeutic, John. And it says, somebody took the time. Time is such a valuable commodity, and people understand, sometimes you'd rather have 15 minutes than $15,000. I'll take them both. But it's a situation where you're right. Here's a guy who the world seems to not know that he exists,
exactly.
And all of a sudden you've made him immortal. Doc Stanley, Sports Enough on the Blake with another Rainbow Show Sports. Lady A has joined us. Lady A, we've got John D. Hertz in, an artist, and we had earlier Harley Farmer. We're talking about art, his work. He is a guy that's a guy that totally started at a short time and doesn't consider himself too talented, stays kind of busy. Lady A, questions for John?
Not really. Well, what kind of art does he do?
I am a pencil artist.
Oh, yeah?
And I do many portraits. Very, very large. Most pencil artists do not do large works because it's so time-consuming,
mm-hmm.
And it's so demanding. But that's the type of work I love to do.
Interesting thing with pencil art, though. How do you keep it from like smearing and running? Do you put like a coating, a spray over it?
After it's done, I do. I spray it with a fixative. But while I'm drawing, I'm a left-hander, and lefties are a mess to begin with. When
we write, got a southpaw here.
So, yeah, I'm a southpaw. And,
I'm laughing because I'm left-handed.
Yeah, exactly. So you know what I'm talking about. We always make a mess
absolutely.
Of paper.
Our
so,
penmanship is lousy, too.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to keep the paper clean.
Right.
But I use a lot of erasers. A lot of erasers.
You know, what's funny about what you say? What's funny about what you say, John, and by the way, welcome to the great Lady A. What you say, John, that's so fascinating is that, you know, I got, when you said that you started to kind of look and see people differently when you started, you know, to sketch them in, you know, in depth. No, I got
right.
the same thing. I started to kind of look and see people differently. You know, when I kind of first got into this business of interviewing and reporting, by the way, big ups and thank you for lots of help to the great Doc Stanley. You know, I have to tell you, John, when I first started interviewing athletes up close and personal, I discovered that everyone and you have an insight that you do. I found out, John, that everyone seems to have their own aura.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And when you get to meet the athletes, we only know athletes by what we read about them and
right.
what we hear about them on by the sportscasters. When you get yeah. to meet them, I'm sure they're different in a lot of ways.
They really are, John, because when they say the eyes are the window to the soul,
right.
I found out that it's true. You know, you'll see a guy on TV, you don't meet him up close and personal. Put it this way, like the boxers. A lot of boxers talk just a lot of jibber jabber about what they're going to do to their opponent. I'm going to do this. When I see him, I'm going to knock one. And sometimes, I'm telling you, I really think now, after having done all of these interviews with these different athletes, John, that I know when a guy is trying to convince himself as much as he's trying to convince me, or if he absolutely
right.
means what he's saying.
Right, exactly.
Right.
How difficult is it sometimes to capture that aura on a piece of paper, do you find?
It's hard for me to say that it's not difficult for me. It just happens. It's something that I don't know how I do it. I literally for a year said to Nancy, if I can do this, you can do this, anybody could do this, because I really didn't believe I had talent.
Mm-hmm,
I didn't understand. If I could do it, why couldn't somebody else do it? And then I started to realize as I went along, and I happened to be friendly with Tony Orlando and Dawn. And Tony said to me, he said, that's the one thing that he can't get out of his head when he sees my work, is that I can actually capture, he feels that I capture the soul, and that you can look into the eyes of my portraits and see the people. And
John,
I don't know how
who
I
just,
do
we,
it.
We just got another call. Who just joined us?
Hello?
Yeah, who just joined us?
Hey, Doc, this is Milo.
Hey, Milo. How you feeling?
I'm good, Doc. How are you?
Hey, Milo.
Okay, glad to have you here.
Hey, Doctor, how are you?
Okay, we're talking with John D. Hurts. Lady A, I'm pretty sure you want to ask him if he did some boxing portraits.
Yeah, that was my next question. How did you know, Doc?
Well, shoot it at him.
Yeah, have you done any portraits of any new championship fighters or?
No, the only famous, truthfully, I've done no sports figures as of yet. I am looking to do sports figures. I have to get out there and get the photographs. I just don't take them off the internet. I have to get to these places and be allowed in to be able to photograph
person.
These
right.
people in person
right.
because I
right.
do like using my own photographs. The
right.
only time
right.
I won't typically is if somebody does commission me and says, hey, you need to do this drawing, you
right.
know, or
right.
I want you to do this. Otherwise, I would love to be able to. I don't have an in with the sports world, so if you guys can get me into the sports
world,
I would love
Sugar
it.
Ray, Sugar Ray Leonard
we'll
recently released a book last released a book last week, Sugar Ray Leonard. I was just wondering
mm-hmm.
if you were interested in doing any of his work.
I would love to.
Great,
great boxer. I mean, just, you know, and he seems to be a great person.
What we'll do, John, the next time we have a big boxing
press
conference, we'll give you a call and drag you down there with us.
I would love
exactly.
it. I would love
shoot
it.
Or as much as you want to.
The only boxer that I know that I've met is Chuck Wepner, if you remember Chuck Wepner.
The big
old leader.
Yeah.
The big old leader.
You know what? You brought up Doc Stanley's portrait up on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Souls on the fourth ever show. We lost Baby Marlo. I hope he's going to come back. So I have a great Chuck Webner story for you. You know, Webner, Beyond Bleeder. In fact, he told it down at Mickey Mantle. I'd heard this story before. It's a great Tommy Kenville, boxing publicist and sage out of Madison Square Garden had told the story. But Webner came down one Wednesday or Thursday at Mickey Mantle's on the legendary Larry Hardy's. He was doing his live shows, the sports box for Mickey Mantle's, and Chuck came down with his lovely wife. And we had everybody there. But Chuck is there, and he gave a cut. Chuck told the story himself. He said, you know, when he fought Ali about 3 or 4 days before the fight, Chuck comes in, and he lays his negligee on the bed. He tells his wife, you're going to be wearing this when you're sleeping with the heavyweight champion of the world. So it's after the fight now, and they come back, and as I learned with, by the grace of God, getting the opportunity to work with Don King, that all the fighters are basically all in the same complex and everything. So they come back to the room, and they sit down, and Ali, Lodge, was down the bottom of the hill, and I guess Chuck was at the top of the hill. So his wife turns to Chuck after about 20 minutes in the fight. She says, look, is he coming up here or I'm going down there?
Oh, my Lord.
Wow.
That was heavy duty.
Roxanne, sports and death on the Blake Radio Network Rainbow Show. Big C, you still with us?
Absolutely, absolutely. John, yeah. How long does it take you? How long do you work on a portrait, per se?
A lot of hours, a lot. But yeah. They can literally, if there's a drawing, there's a couple of them that I did, one called Under the Bridge. There was a gentleman under the bridge and crossing over from Paradise Island to Nassau in the Bahamas. And I did a 30 by 40 of him. And
wow.
His beard alone took me about 70 hours.
Yeah,
oh, my God.
Now,
I can imagine.
25
wow.
of the year, the white beard and the... Yeah.
Right, and there's another one in there called A Man of Many Colors. Just a wonderful, wonderful human being, this man. He's tattooed literally from his neck to his ankles. And
oh,
I have him wearing
leg,
a pair
one
of
leg,
shorts.
One leg Willie's in here, too.
One leg Willie's in there, but the gentleman with the tattoos, that drawing is 5 feet tall. I couldn't get a board to do his actual height. He's around 6 feet, and they didn't make a board big enough for me to do his full size.
Right.
So I did it 5 feet, and you can imagine tattooed head to toe that it was.
Yeah,
it took me
a couple
hours.
Yeah, too. Oh, yeah.
That's a lot of rendering to bring out a lot of the detail in there. I could imagine
right.
if it's your pencil drawing.
Yes, it is when you think of it when you paint. When someone paints, and I do not know how to paint, it's someday I'm looking forward to learning how to paint. But when you use a paintbrush, it can go on rather quickly.
Right.
When you use a pencil, there is no speed. You just can't do it with speed because it's literally a pencil point.
Wow.
You lose a lot of the detail too, right? You lose a lot of the detail too if you just if you don't take your time to kind of
exactly.
capture.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. And I. I'm very, very detail-oriented when it comes to my drawings.
John, you a baseball fan, John?
Oh, I love baseball.
Favorite player?
That's a game that I love.
You have a favorite team?
I listened to you with Harvey Frommer on, and I was listening to that and about the Yankees and the prices and everything that's going on with them. I was a devout Yankee fan. Having a little problem with them these days, though, because it's just crazy over there. And since they left the old stadium, it's just not the same.
Whatever you do, just don't ask Dusty if he likes CC Sabathia, though. Okay.
Well, at least you know what.
I love all sports.
At least he finally got over Manny Ramirez.
Oh my God! Got it.
I'm getting started on that. All right, panel. I'm gonna have to say good night. Have a good one, John. It was nice meeting you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for being
on
the panel, John.
Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Well,
thank
good luck.
You.
John, you leaving us? John, leaving?
I'm here.
No, Big
okay,
C.
No, Big C. Well, no, John. Okay, so what we're gonna do? We're gonna let you hang here, talk a bit. I got my little boxing crew here. They're ready to talk a little bit. Ding, 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 Lady A. We're hoping that Barry Marlo comes back this week. The man, considered by many to be the best fighter in the world, pound for pound, if not definitely one of the best undefeated, Floyd Mayweather Jr., vicious Victor Ortiz, press conference this week. And Lady A, thoughts and concepts. Will Mayweather be able to beat Ortiz?
Not going to go the distance.
They're not going to go the distance?
No. It's not.
Okay.
Mayweather's just too much for him. It's not going to go the distance.
Well, the big thing here, too, is that I remember when he fought somebody else, and they would say, well, Doc, the bottom line, is he going to pick somebody that he's not going to be able to beat? Dusty feels this is a sparring session. This is a guy that the Southpaw is going to help him to get in shape or get into the mindset and the strategy he's going to use against Pacquiao. And on the other hand, what we've forgotten here, first of all, Berto was not the world's greatest talent. And second of all, before that fight, even during that fight, there was a lot of questions, Lady A, about Ortiz's heart.
Yeah. I mean, when he just quit against Maidana, oh, my God.
Well, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's just, we've talked about showing the heart of a champion. I mean, obviously, I don't know, Harold's not with us today, but, he's always talked about that. He's always talked about, being ready mentally and how much – you have to listen. Mayweather is the top fighter, no matter what you say. Hands down, right now, he's the top fighter. And mentally, sometimes I don't think that people get themselves in tune with what they have to do in the ring. I mean, when you looked at the fight with Berto and Victor Ortiz, you saw just on the walk-in and the ring walk that Berto looked like he wasn't even ready to fight.
Lady A,
I think we brought those points out a few weeks ago, Coco, and Dusty brought it up, that you have to be mentally prepared to step into the ring. Doc, you say all the time, this is a sport that will get you killed.
This is a serious business sport.
Somebody had a lot of heart, and Mayweather said, heart can get you killed in this business. And like Miguel said, you can go in at your best and get killed. And John, we were talking about Lady A, talking about Ray Leonard. I remember Ray Leonard said, you have to be mentally ready when you go in that ring. Berto, like I said, Schaefer had told me.
But Doc, this is where you got to come in.
Hold on a second. He was my last interview, and he said that he felt, without question, Ortiz was going to win the fight. Dusty, what you got to say?
But I'm telling you, that you cannot castigate, and using last night's fights with Devin Alexander, you cannot castigate a guy because of his immaturity and lack of confidence, which conjures up next week's fight with Klitschko and I've been researching that and hearing it. Now,
that's going to be a good fight, Dusty. That's going to be a darn good fight, man.
Yeah.
Klitschko and damn good fight. It's going to turn out that way. As we all know, Hay has been talking an awful lot. And this is one of the few times I think he's actually gotten into Klitschko's head. Klitschko legitimately doesn't like him. He wants to beat him up. And quite frankly, I think he's gotten into Klitschko's head.
A lot of folks, and this is what I'm trying to tell you guys, that a lot of folks using Hayes and Ortiz as examples, first of all, the experts, and I agree with the experts because I thought about it myself, that if Hayes, the haymaker, gets into Klitschko the first three or four rounds, because Klitschko does not have the confidence in his ability. But if you let him ride and he'll sit and stab you with that jab all night, you lose.
And
you
absolutely right.
Will come
agree,
in and it will hurt him. He'll try to hurt him like Corey Sanders, Lehman Brewster, and even Sam the Nigerian Nightmare did. Knocked him down three times before Klitschko staggered him and he lost a decision. But that's what you got. That's what Hayes has to do with Klitschko.
And Hayes going to win. Hayes going to win.
And hurt him. Now,
so Hayes going
to
win.
But Dusty, last night, what happened to our boy from Brooklyn, Powell? I mean, he was number one ranked guy.
He got beat by K-9 unanimous decision.
I mean, what happened last night? He didn't have it?
That's one fight that wasn't televised. I only saw about two or three trailers, and K-9 was pounding the crap out of him in the last round, and he was rope-a-doping, and they gave K-9 the decision by unanimous decision.
Fox Stanley Sports Network, the Blake Radio Show, Sports Network. Gentlemen, real quick, because we
Let me just finish this analogy here, okay?
Go ahead.
Now, Lady A.
But Dusty, do it this week. Do it this week.
Well, hold a second. Lady A, you dismiss Victor Ortiz. He doesn't have a chance. I don't agree with you.
Well, we're not saying he don't have a chance, Dusty.
First of all,
beating Berto doesn't make him a world beater. We still got a question to Kool-Aid that's in his heart.
You talked about the mindset. Maidana is three or four fights away, gone. You can't be beating him up because of that. The man is going to come in there. He's not going to give up his title that easy. Yes, everybody believes, including myself, that Mayweather is supposed to pull it out. But then he is not the Maidana victim of before. He's a kid who now is the title owner. And he says, hey, I'm in with the elite. He was interviewed.
Hold up. Let me finish.
No, let me finish.
Talk to him.
And the guys that I want to fight now are Pacquiao and Mayweather. And I think I can hold my own.
Doc, hold up.
How many other people has Victor Ortiz beaten since this fight that he gave up? That he gave up to Maidana. How many more fights has he had since Maidana?
He has two fights since Maidana.
Nate Campbell. Yeah.
Anthony Peterson, who was supposed to kick the crap out of him, and he beat Anthony Peterson badly and knocked him down twice and busted his face. And then he fought Berto.
Okay, Dusty, but you were that impressed with him that you're going to say that he's going to be Mayweather?
I'm telling you that I'm impressed
by the fact that... Dusty, whatever you have for breakfast...
All of you are saying poor Victor Ortiz, a slam dunk for Mayweather. You forget Mayweather's been out of the gym For two years.
He's been out of acclimation.
Victor Ortiz is not going to walk in there and let Mayweather hurt him. Mayweather is not going to lose.
He's not going to lose Ortiz, Dusty, and he's not going to fight a guy that he can't beat with Pacquiao sitting there with all the money.
That's true, Doc. Even if
in the fifth round they had to tell Victor Ortiz, Victor, you're messing this thing up. Sit down.
Do you really believe
Victor Ortiz is not going
to... Oh, come on.
Just to add to what Doc is saying, look at the repertoire of Mayweather. The quality of fighters that he has fought. Okay, maybe some of them you like to say, Dusty, they're tomato cans. Okay, but how many fights has he fought? Okay. And the quality of guys that he's fought are compared to Victor Ortiz. Come on, bro. You can't tell me that you actually think Victor Ortiz is going to pull this off.
Now, Lady A, I want you and Doctor to let me come to Dusty's defense for a moment.
Go ahead, Mel, we're tired of you. Mel, hang up. We're tired of you coming to Dusty's defense.
Let me play.
John, Mel was a former WWF wrestler, so like this is like a tag team move he does. He likes to flip in here and jump in here with Dusty, a tag team move.
I'm telling you that his mindset is different than it was, and he's not going to let Mayweather beat him. But Mayweather could beat him. I'm telling you, it's going to be a fight where Mayweather's going to have to earn that victory.
All right, okay, that's enough. We've had enough. John,
I'm
not
saying that's
going to
roll over.
Can I get a word in edgewise here?
Yeah, hold on. Let me let John finish up. John, you got a pick here, Mayweather and Ortiz? Did we lose John? John left us?
Okay, let's hear Coco's version, because I can't wait for this defense that he's talking about.
I got to come to Dusty's defense in this sense, you two. Number one, you already stated that Mayweather's been away for about 2 years, okay?
That's number one.
The other big thing is, even though Lady A had it down about how great he is by giving you the shoulder and his defense, As far as I'm concerned, I might get some heat from the panel for this, but I got to come to Dusty's defense also on the fact that Mayweather is not a great offensive fighter.
Mayweather is not a great offensive fighter. You don't like Mayweather, and right now you're
in
2 weeks with Dusty. Next 2 weeks, you and Dusty will not call in.
No.
I see the coup.
I'm not denying the fact. Hold up, guys. Let me just put some clarity. I am not denying what Dusty said about Victor coming in with reckless abandon against Berto and showing that he, you know, he was there and he was going to do what he had to do. Fine, no problem. But we're talking about Mayweather.
I never dismissed him.
And we're talking about money Mayweather, who's broke.
I like that.
And needs to make money, okay, against Pacquiao.
Yeah.
The fight that everybody wants to see. So
yeah,
I can definitely
That's the ambulance coming for little Coco and Dusty. Let him in.
Hey, Doc. That's New York's bravest stopping by to say that we have a smoking hot show here tonight.
Doc Stanley, Sports the Devil and the Blake, and the Rainbow Soul Transport. Hey, you know what? Is John still with us? I thought we lose John. John here? Okay. You know what happened? The guy.
I'm here.
Okay, John. John, you boxing wise, you got any thoughts on the Mayweather Ortiz fight?
No, I'll be honest with you, I'm not that up on boxing.
Okay.
Baseball is my love and my passion. And
Willie Mays is your favorite player. Who's give me your favorite two or three pitchers.
Two or three pitchers.
Well,
I grew up watching. I love Juan Marichal.
You are the second guy today that I've run into who mentioned the greatest Latin pitcher of all time.
Absolutely.
And it's funny. I mean, I remember a game, and the Mets, it's the Met game, you know, it's the third inning, and the Mets against the Houston Astros. Oh, okay, out in Milwaukee, at the end of three innings, it's Giants nothing and Braves nothing, Marichal against Swan. It's in the seventh innings, it's the Giants nothing, the Braves nothing, Marichal and Swan. They're in tenth inning now. It's in a game right now. They're in 10th inning, and it's still Marichal and Swan, nothing. They're in the 13th inning, and it's still nothing. Both Marichal and Swan, they're in the game with 16 innings. Willie Mays hit a home run to win the game. Marichal and Swan both went 16 innings and one of the greatest pitchers of all time. And I think Marichal was unquestionably the greatest right Latin pitcher ever. And right there in the top three, four that I've ever seen. Okay, who else you got, John?
Bob Gibson.
Great Bob Gibson.
Sandy Koufax.
Koufax.
Different era. And in today's world, I mean, I love Mo. I think Mariano Rivera is absolutely amazing.
The greatest
but he
relief
does.
Pitcher that ever breathed,
ever.
John, in my personal opinion.
He's the greatest closer. Okay,
greatest
because
closer.
Back in the old days, you know, Dick Raddatz came in the seventh inning. You know, relief pitchers came in the seventh, eighth. They didn't come in and throw four pitches or one inning, and then if they pitched 3 days in a row, they couldn't pitch anymore. You know, Goose Gossage, Sparky Lyle, Dick Raddatz, Luis Arroyo, they came in the seventh, eighth, and pitched two or three innings.
Right.
Mary
different
Sheen,
game
with that.
That's true, Doc. But Mariano's been great for a long
time.
That's true, but Mariano's been great for a long time, Doc.
Listen, you know what? That's true, but you know what? I love him. He's a friend. But it ain't hard to be that great on the Yankees and pitch one inning.
No, it's a different game today, though, Doc.
Huh?
You know, it's a different game today than it was a few years ago.
It's a different game, but I'm just saying, you know, I remember Catfish Hunter told me something I'll never forget. And we were talking, how the pitches at the era, you know, the complete games and everything. And Caffrey gave me one of the funniest lines ever. Caffrey said the reason why they had the guys out in the bullpen, he said, because they didn't want them in the game in the first place.
Here's, you know, I met Al Raboski. You remember him, the mad Hungarian?
Al Raboski, yeah.
Remember him? I met him, and when I met him, he said, you know, that when we played baseball, there was no such thing as a rotator cuff.
Wow.
They probably didn't have one after a while.
Exactly. You just played with it or not. So
it's amazing. Dr. Yep. A. Sports Def on the Blake with Rainbow Soul Sports Def. She's got about a good 5 minutes. So, gentlemen,
Doc, can I just mention my website because nobody can see my artwork from
John, you better,
the
you better,
radio?
You go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
My website is Graphite. That's Graphite. PencilArtist.com, GraphitePencilArtist.com.
John, you got to say it another 3 times. Go ahead, John, another 3 times.
GraphitePencilArtist.com, GraphitePencilArtist.com. And anybody that's listening to this show, write me. I'd love to hear from you. Absolutely would love to hear from you.
Hey, John,
and
just a quick question.
Yes,
to deviate a little bit from the subject matter. Do you actually do any graphic novels at all, or?
No, I have not.
Oh, you've never ventured into that? Okay,
no,
just
this
wondering.
Is, as I was saying, this is so brand new to me that I've really only been doing my own work for the last 4 years,
okay.
And I'm sort of feeling my way through the art world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to figure out what the next moves are going to be,
mm-hmm.
Because I, too, would love to be a sports artist. But getting into these teams and getting in to be able to have these people want to draw you is another, you know, have you draw them is a different thing that I have to explore and figure out how to get in to see the Yankees. I do work with charities, and I would love to work with some of these ball players or boxers that have charities, because I do limited editions of my work so that we can sell limited editions and part of the money can go to their charities.
John, no doubt the next big boxing press conference, you know, we go to, we're going to drag you along with us. So
you got it.
With us on that.
You got
Rooney?
It.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Doctor. Johnny, a quick four actors that I would love to see your work, how they would look after you finish doing your thing and putting them on canvas or whatever. Four, I'll make it brief. One is Denzel Washington.
Right.
Al Pacino.
Love it.
Robert
Love
De Niro.
Mm-hmm.
And the great one, Jackie Gleason.
Oh. That's interesting. I didn't expect that one.
Gleason was born on Montgomery Street in Brooklyn. You name those guys, Rooney, and I was thinking, oh, about it, Chris. I've met three of those guys. I remember it was Denzel at the Garden. I met Pacino at my first great mentor, Dr. Frank Bannister, the late great Dr. Frank Bannister. We were up at his office. He had told Julius, and I think people who I say Julius, I'm talking about Julius Erving, to come by his office, and we were in his office, and he said, hey, you know, Pacino's office is right around the corner, and we went around to see him, and De Niro, one of the retired police officers that I know, was working for De Niro, who's a big boxing fan, too. We've got about another good 2 or 3 minutes, real quick. Dusty, Paul Williams fight the tough Cuban guy. I just need a
and
quick yes or no. Could we have a recurrence of what happened before?
Well, there is a possibility. I hope not. But this guy is undefeated. He's one of the 6 or 7 Cuban refugees that came over on a boat with 14 people and defected from Cuba. And it's funny. And they all live in South Beach, Miami. It's all Cuban conclave. And this guy is a tough, again, southpaw junior middleweight with knockout power. But so I don't know whether Williams a bit of more than he can chew.
So
yeah, but
give me a prediction. Yeah, your prediction.
Well, I'm all pumped up over the return of Big Paul, and that's what I'm going with. All pumped up over the return of Big Paul.
And Rooney, and I know this has a possibility of fight of the year.
Believe it or not, I'm not going to say we have a possibility in this fight.
Larry Hodges is going to tell us goodbye. We're going to call in a few minutes and do sports there with the mic on, lights off. Leave your three thoughts. You guys have to say everything for Live your life today and stand before God tomorrow. Life's most persistent, most urgent question is, what are you doing for others? Service to others is what you pick. Your on earth. I shall be saved. God bless you all. Trust in God.
God bless everyone.
Lord, I bless. Thank you. And all honor and praise to your holy name. Amen. Mr. Hardesty, you can come on and talk out if you want to with Sue.
This concludes another edition of Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. We thank you for listening and encouraging you to tell a friend about Sports in Depth with Doc Stanley. You can hear that and many other great programs on the Blake Radio Network. Have a great day.
Well, that's it, gang. We're closing up. A little time off, talking off the air. John, thanks so much for being with us. Oh, John's gone already. Okay. He left. Okay. Gang,
Yeah.
Go ahead. We'll chat a little bit.
Hey, Doc, well, how much time we got? That's a story that I'm dying to tell.
Go ahead.
I'll make it brief. But I know Lady A will love this story, and I think Casino will like it. You ready, gang? It's the first time I ever got booed, and it wasn't as a professional. Okay, this is the deal. I was wrestling for Richmond Hill High School back in the day. You know this guy. You know this was a long time ago. Wrestling for Richmond Hill High. That Saturday, they had a wrestling matinee at the Garden about 12 or 1 o'clock. Main event, superstar Billy Graham, maybe the greatest bad guy villain of all time, against the great, and I mean great, Bruno Sammartino. So the match goes on, and the guys were what we call in the business very stiff, which basically means they beat the tar out of each other. So I leave the match, and I mean I'm all puffed up. I am psyched for the match. Psyched to the match. Well, that Monday, our Richmond Hill wrestling team had a meet against a squad called Newtown High. I believe Newtown's in Queens.
Newtown is out here by me.
Okay, thank you, Lady A.
Corona.
Okay, so we're going against Newtown High at Newtown. So it's considered a road trip for us, even though we're in Queens also. But it's a road trip, right? So I'm all pumped up over the Bruno Superstar match, all psyched. So we get to the meet. I'm on. First thing I do, first and second of the match, pick this guy up and body slam him. Bam! Ref blows the whistle. Disqualification. Body slam. You're out. I look at him and kind of growl. Look at the crowd growl. As I'm walking off the Newtown mat, the crowd boos me. The crowd boos me loudly. I have to tell you, panel doc, to this day, that's the greatest sound that I have ever heard.
That's good. Hilarious.
The greatest sound was the booze. Dusty, those booze. Man, I was all high. Dusty, the greatest sound to this day that I've ever heard.
Well, let me tell you something about booze. Let me tell you something about booze.
It's like that great line Linwood Simon said, the silence was as loud, the loudest I ever heard.
Okay, let me tell you about booze. I was a very popular amateur fighter. I walked in there, hey, there go Louis, knock out Louis, I realized that the reason I got all those cheers, because I was knocking out blacks and spicks. But every time I fought a white guy, as popular as I was, boo, kill him, murder the sucker. I said, so that's the way it is. Them suckers, them pale faces never went the distance. I either cut them or busted them up, made them pee blood for a week. When you said booey, I said, is that the way it is? Okay, I'm not popular when I'm fighting a pale face. Okay, I'll fix you for that, man.
But
listen, you know, Dusty, it's funny you said that about peeing blood for a week. You know that? I heard that after the Diego Corrales, Jose Luis Castillo fight, you know, God rest his soul, Diego Corrales,
right.
That he was peeing blood for almost 2 weeks.
Because Luis Castillo was a horrific body puncher, and which leads into our boy Mayweather. Luis Castillo gave Mayweather a bad body punch. I mean, big punishment in the time that they fought him. This is why I felt that Castillo got robbed fighting Mayweather. But this is a question I have for you, Lady A. Victor Ortiz, do you really believe
from the Maidana situation. Now, let's talk about this. Was such a punk, such a quitter, that he will that he doesn't have a ghost of a chance against Floyd. Look, everybody figures Floyd is going to eat him for lunch.
So that's, on the real side, it's not about his heart, it's about talent. He's just not good to beat Mayweather. That's about him. And I bring the hard stuff up, but maybe unfair, but he just doesn't have the talent to beat Mayweather.
But this is what I'm trying to make you understand. Okay? I still feel, despite all the come downs, that Mayweather is Pacquiao's Waterloo. I haven't changed from that. But do you really feel that Ortiz is so inept and so lax that
you know what it is? You know what it is with Ortiz?
If you're saying Mayweather can beat Pacquiao, then why do you think Ortiz has a chance against Mayweather?
Because it's not going to be a slam dunk. This is what I'm trying to make you understand.
Listen, Dusty, I'm not saying a slam dunk. I'm saying whatever it is, when the smoke clears, Mayweather will be the winner.
To be honest with you, I really think going 8 or 9 rounds, to me, is not bad against Mayweather. Okay, because look at Diego Corrales. He got knocked down 5 times against Mayweather. 5 times. Does that make him any less of a forever good fighter? I don't think so.
That was his first world title. No, that was his second world title. Diego Corrales was a slam dunk winner over Mayweather. Mayweather beat the crap out of him to make him no
mind. Let me say this right now. You know what? Boy, this is the greatest panel in the world. I'm sitting here with pride, man. My crew, baby. You know what I mean?
Thank you.
And anytime somebody gets bad, right away I just sit Dusty. Hey, Dusty, you got a question for him? Boom, sit Dusty right on the back. He got him now. You know, because I know right behind Lou Coco ready to body slam on part 2. I got him, Dusty. That's me, baby. Bam.
Okay, Dusty. Mayweather-Judah. The Mayweather-Judah fight. Look at Mayweather against Judah.
What about
that fight?
Judah
was crying at the end.
Let me tell you about Mayweather-Judah.
He was crying at the end, Dusty. How are you going
to
say Mayweather?
Judah won the first. Listen to me. Judah won the first 5 rounds.
Sure did.
Mayweather was exactly correct when in the press conference. It says Judah is a front runner. He'll begin to tire, and I'll get him in the end.
Dusty, you know what's funny about that? Don King said at the press conference that they wanted to take Mayweather into the deep water, and what happened when Zab got the deep water, he's the one that drowned.
Exactly. And that's exactly what Mayweather said, and it came out exactly the right way. But what I'm trying to tell you is that do you think, or the inference I got from you folks, hey, this is a slam dunk for Mayweather. No, it's not.
No, I'm not saying, listen.
No, it's not.
Do not. Mayweather's going to win.
You're talking about a knockout in the 8th round.
I'm saying he's not going to make it to the 8th or 9th round. I'm saying that.
Okay. All right. That's it. But I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so.
All right.
I think Ortiz is going to give the better of his accounting. He's done with the Maidana demons. Maidana's fighting Eric Morales. People don't know that? Eric Morales. No.
He already fought Morales.
No. I'm sorry. Maidana's fight. Oh,
did you see Morales' eye after that fight?
No. I'm sorry. No. I got it mixed up. He's fighting another prominent dude. Oh, anyway, let's skip that. But I'm saying that from what's happening, I believe that Ortiz will give a better accounting of himself, and I would not be surprised if Ortiz pulls it out, even though it's a slam dunk for Mayweather. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that Mayweather's coming out of 2 years of
listen,
nothing.
Like Harold Weston says, you want to make a bet?
No, I don't bet. I'm not a betting person. But
Dusty,
I'm telling you.
Hey, relax, Bob.
Dusty, Lady A. I'm sorry, Dusty, Lady A, Doc, I have one bold prediction that I have to get in before we run out of time.
Yeah,
you all heard it here first. You heard it here first, all right?
Okay.
I don't know if it's going to be Pacquiao or Mayweather, but one of them is going to take, well, in the interim before they fight each other, one of them is going to take one of those keep busy fights, keep the rust off fights,
get knocked out, and the whole thing will be moot. Take my word for it. I don't know if it's going to be Pacquiao or Mayweather. One of them is going to take one of those just to keep busy fights and get dropped, and it's going to be kitty by the door, the whole thing.
Okay, let me ask you, do you think it could be Canelo Alvarez fighting Pacquiao? Pacquiao got a $75 million offer to fight Canelo Alvarez, man.
Hey, let's just talk about that billionaire who offered that. I'm not sure which one is going to be, but one of them is going to, like I said, take one of those just to keep busy fights from some unknown or somebody that they're not expected to lose to, get knocked out, and there goes $50 million down the drain.
I'm telling you guys, the fight that I want to see, you guys aren't talking about. We talked about it last week. Is Sergio Martinez? I want to see Sergio Martinez. And Lou DiBella talked about it at the conference. It's a press conference. How he wants Martinez to fight Pacquiao.
Lou DiBella talks a lot of nonsense, but it's not going to happen. I personally don't want to see.
You just dissed Doc's boy.
Yeah.
He's not allowed on the show anymore, Doc.
It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And the fact of the matter is that you're probably right because Marquez is fighting Pacquiao, and that's the one that's giving Pacquiao the hardest
problems in
the
past.
Mm-hmm. And that could be
fight's going to happen again? They fought already twice.
Yeah, sometime in November. The third one, the trilogy.
They're going to fight again? They already signed it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they did sign it. I think they did,
yeah.
Recently then, right? Recently. That was recently.
It's going to be the third fight.
What fight are we talking about, Dustin?
Marquez,
number three.
Marquez and Pacquiao.
Yep.
Right. Marquez and Pacquiao,
number
three.
I tell you something. That is a dangerous fight for Pacquiao.
Very dangerous.
That's what I'm saying.
Hold on, gentlemen. Don't everybody hold on, gang.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Okay, the show's not streaming
until
we make it cut off down the line. John just called. He wanted to thank everybody. He's ecstatic about being on the panel. I told him, send $250 directly to the Doc Stanley United Way, and we'll get him back
on the Doc Stanley Foundation.
But he just called. He had a great time. He's ecstatic. And like I said, there's no crew better than my crew. And without further ado, part two. Bored to death with the mic on, lights off, my crew, talking to Sweet Science, the sweet first lady of boxing, the body slam, a little Coco, and hey, what I'm trying to get you to see, just Daniel Baby Lois, who beat, I haven't heard Pale Face.
The racist fighter.
You know what, I think about that Bob, remember that Bob Hope movie, Son of Pale Face?
Son of Pale Face.
I remember at the end of the movie, they had the Lone Ranger, they had Roy Rogers, they had, he needs all the help he can get. Dusty!
I'm sorry, Doc. I was just wondering if anybody had caught the interview with Greta Van Susteren had on with Sugar Ray Leonard regards to his book.
Yeah, I saw it.
You saw it?
Channel 11 had... He made a book. He wrote a book, and the highlight of the story is that he was sexually abused. And I'm saying, he brought that, and he had to deal with demons, and he brought it out now because I don't want this to happen to fighters. To me, that's bunk and garbage. And I'll tell you why. Reverend Abernathy wrote a book of his partnership with Martin Luther King. The book was just a so-so book. But it became a bestseller. Why? Because in one chapter, he talked about how Martin Luther King was a womanizer, and every hotel that they stayed, he had one of his broads meet him at the hotel.
Right, that's what sold the book.
Yeah, that became a bestseller because of that stupid chapter. Now,
that's what sold
and then
the
he couldn't prove it. He couldn't prove it. He says, well, were you in the room? Did you see them? No, I was outside on the fringes, but I would see them come to see him. Well, did you see? You could tell that was all crap. That's the same thing with Barbara Walters when she wrote her biography.
and she revealed that she had a long-standing
romance with Brooks. Yes.
Remember Brooks? And,
they were supposed to be married,
and Brooks was going to get a divorce, and blah, 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 blah. And that became a bestseller because he talked about that
that's
one stupid BS chapter.
Exactly. In other words, it's like that new book, Doc Stanley and His Real Life with Liber Archie.
if it's true,
what are you saying? So you're saying that Sugar Ray Leonard made up the story to sell books?
I'm not saying that.
Go ahead, Lady A, go get him.
No, I'm not saying that he wrote up the story. I'm saying
you're
that
saying that the
book
is crap. You're saying that the book is crap, not to buy it.
No, I'm not. No, see, you're reading wrong. I'm saying in order for him to sell that book, which is probably just another box of story, he had to put in the salient, dirty little points that he was sexually abused since he was an amateur. And that's what made now he's made the book tour. He had a book tour in Borders. He did this, that, and the other. And all they talked about was his sexual abuse.
Gosh. Did you read the book yet? Did you read the book?
No, I didn't even bother buying the book. I saw enough. I heard enough on the TV to make it. This is another cartoon. I ain't going to buy that garbage.
Hey, Lady A, Dusty's saying if it wasn't for those salacious details,
exactly,
it may not make the bestseller list.
Exactly. I don't know if it even made
the bestseller list yet. I just know it came out like last week, but I was just wondering what.
Yeah, but he's going to store.
Did
he's on every station.
Yeah, he's going to doing the books, the talk shows now because of his book. The same thing with Bob.
Yeah, he's on the tour now. He's on the tour.
But did you read Oscar De La Hoya's book?
Yes, I read Oscar's book.
What did you think about that book?
It was a pretty good book, but not enough to make a movie out of it. I asked him point blank, "Are you going to make a movie out of your life?" I said, "And who's going to play you?" I said, "No. Is it the American Son?" And then he has it in Spanish, also Spanish and English. And I went to the book signing and I talked to him and I interviewed him there. And it was all about how he had to get his head together and he felt guilty because he was the one that bought his mother the Camel cigarettes that caused her, because she was a chain smoker and she caused breast cancer. And then he talked about the emotion, about feeling guilty and going to the Olympics and how he decided to fight. Even though she was dying, and when she died,
The interesting thing about that book that I found interesting in the beginning few chapters of that book, I don't know if you caught it, the whole situation with Carlos Ortiz.
With Carlos Ortiz, and there was another chapter there where people hated him because he was not Mexican enough.
Right.
And hated him because he beat Julio Cesar Chavez, who was a Mexican idol. Now he was Mexican, not Oscar De La Hoya. And how his father pushed him into boxing and pulled him out of baseball. He was actually a good little league pitcher, a high school pitcher, and he walked into the field, yanked the glove and the ball out of his hand, and you're not going to play baseball and force him to be, all of these things. Was it interesting? Yes, it was interesting, but. Bestseller list, movie, so what? And he catered to both English and Spanish. And, so to me, it doesn't really make a difference. I mean, they throw in the salient points because that's what's going to, and the editor is the one that advises you. That's the one that's going to tell you this is the part that we need to make it interesting.
I mean, books like that, and Lady A, too, and I can't wait to hear what Doc says, but it's like the first book, and by the way, everybody talked about him like a dog, but he turned out to be right, Jose Canseco.
Yes, Juiced.
Yeah.
Yes,
right,
Juiced.
The steroids.
The first one, but he wrote a second one, too. Did you read the second one yet?
He wrote a second one, which was
and no one believed him. No one believed him.
Yeah, nobody believed him.
It's funny because the first... And, the second I read that book, I think the book came out like a good 6 years ago already.
You're probably right.
The funny thing was is that whole situation when he was talking about the Oakland A's. And then when he left the Oakland A's the way they were injecting each other in the locker room.
Yeah.
And then when he was talking about the Texas Rangers, how prevalent it was there. And the first person that popped in my mind... Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah,
the first person that popped in my mind is Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah.
I say,
Texas
Rangers. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because he came from Seattle, then he went to Texas Rangers, signed that big $250 million contract, and that's when supposedly he started doing steroids with his cousin.
Right.
And Canseco knew about it, and Canseco hated him, ratted him out because A-Rod being a playboy was after his wife, and he got pissed off at him. He wanted to beat his ass for that. But the fact of the matter is that he was right. Now that book has some substance, but they laughed it off. But now they
now you know something, Dustin, Lady A. Yeah. I believe he was only a few home runs away from the magical number of 500. Do you think that he got blacklisted out of baseball because of the book, or you think that it's still that just diminished to the point where no one could use him?
I think it was a combination of both.
Because
he bounced to the Yankees. And then he bounced to some other teams. He's ridiculed because he was in the outfield and he went to catch a ball and it bounced off his head.
His head, yeah.
I think it went for a home run or something. Yeah, and he was dating Madonna. So it was a ridicule. The whole host of ridicules, you know. And then when he wrote the book, the expose, of course, now they had to get rid of him, you know. But anyway, overall, what I'm saying, Sugar Ray, yes, he's out there. I'm saying so what. That to me is part of the selling point of the book, you know. But anyway, let's get back to the debate. Now next week we have Haymaker and Klitschko. What do you guys think about that?
Hey, I like Hay for that fight.
Why?
You know, I just think that a few things coupled with what Coco was saying about him getting into his head, and I think it's just a different fight, a fighter than what he's accustomed to fighting. And remember, the Klitschko's, they fight like that old European style, that fight. Once this guy gets inside, it's over on him.
But that's Emmanuel Stewart training. That's what he did to Miguel Cotto.
Yeah.
He has him fighting that way. You know, it may work for Miguel Cotto, and it's worked for the Klitschko's, it worked for Lennox Lewis. My idea, in fact, I shouldn't say pleasures, but I'm homebound because of my surgery. I have enough time to search the web and get opinion of people. Freddie Roach, Dan Raphael, all these guys are saying David Hayes has to make history in the first five rounds, and I'm saying they're right. And then they explain because of the fact that Klitschko is not a confident fighter.
No.
And in the first five rounds, he has to get acclimated to see what he can. And if Hayes takes him out of his game.
Well, here's the thing too. The first, I'm going to say this, and Dusty, you could disagree with me. I mean, you boxed, right? I mean, in talking to a few fighters already, when I spoke to Aaron Pryor Jr., he confirmed this to me. Would you say that the first, say, 2-3 rounds of a boxing match are pretty much a feeling out period?
Absolutely. It could even be the first round. And I can say after the first round, I said, oh, well, I know what this guy got. So in the second round, I'm going to take him out because I know what he got in the first round.
But the first two, three rounds, I would say, is a warm-up kind of feeling out period.
Exactly.
Okay. So this is what I say. I say if Hay starts off the fight confident enough, sets a tone the first 3 to 5 rounds, I have to agree with that statement that they're saying, that the first 3 to 5 rounds, get himself acclimated and show this guy, hey, I'm here for good.
You're on point, exactly.
And, Lady A, not only are you right, but he has got to come in there and prove that he can get inside that long jab and reach a Klitschko.
And they haven't seen a fighter like that, guys. They haven't. They haven't seen. All they do is hit people outside with the jab, keep them outside. I'm going to tell you this right now. If they were fighting Tyson 10 years ago, they'd have been done. Because once Tyson gets inside, it's over. It's over.
They would have been retired a long time ago.
Bomb.
Now, David Hayes won his portion of the heavyweight championship by fighting and beating that giant from Russia.
That's the 7-1 guy.
The big Russian guy.
Right. Did you see the beating he gave Ivaliev?
Yeah.
Dropped him, staggered him.
Right, so he could do the same thing to Klitschko.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly what I'm saying. If he lives up to everything he said. Now, I don't know if you folks missed Saturday's Max Kellerman, he has something called one-on-one.
I did see it, actually,
When he had the two fighters talking to each other,
sitting down face to face.
Oh, yeah, the round table, thing
round,
he does.
And you can see Klitschko being a little unnerved, as you can see Hayes talking his ghetto trash.
Hayes is definitely in his head.
No,
he's right, though, Lady Hayes. Hayes is definitely in his head. There's no question about it. I mean, even Tyler said, wow, I've never seen you like this.
Exactly.
But Tyler, never seen you like this.
Right.
Hayes is definitely in his head. He doesn't like Hayes. He wants to punish Hayes. And if Hayes, you know what, Lady Hayes, what Hayes has to do to me, in my opinion, panel, he has got to come in there early and prove that this is not going to be, like he said, one of those snooze fests where he just where Klitschko just gets to sit back and go,
boring European thing
Thank
that he
you.
Does.
Yes, 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 Lady
the same
he's
boring thing, you know.
You guys remember
that. That jab, right hand,
Do you guys remember when Klitschko fought three guys? See if you remember. A little trivia question. Corey Sanders from South Africa.
Yeah, I remember that fight.
The southpaw that tore him a new butt.
Mm-hmm.
Layman Brewster, who destroyed him about after the
I saw that fight too, Layman Brewster.
And then Samuel Peters, the Nigerian
nightmare.
He dropped him three times. Only when Simon Peter got a little tired and careless and Klitschko hit him with a lucky left hook and staggered him, did Peter lose. Other than that, Peter was going to be heavyweight champ. So this is what David Hayes is saying. And he mentioned those three guys to Klitschko Saturday night at the one-on-one.
Is that on demand?
It's going to be on demand. It should be on demand, HBO on demand.
Okay, I got to check it out.
Are you sure?
Because I thought that was a 4:45 regular thing. I know they were pay-per-view.
No. Last night, Boxing After Dark, after the fight finished and Matisse and Alexander finished fighting, they had it last night.
Okay.
Max Kellerman one-on-one.
Oh, no, I saw that part. Well, let me ask you this then, Dusty, and you too, Lady A. Does Hay fight as good as he talks? That's the question. Does Hay fight as good as he talks? That's going to be the question.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to have a problem backing it up. I think anybody that, especially him, you know, he already knows what he has to do. I mean, this is his shot. This is something that they put it on, they put it off. They put it on, they put it off. Reminds me like the guy, I pick things up and put them down.
I love that commercial, Lady A.
You know,
I love that commercial.
Reminds me of that guy. I mean, come on, listen. This has been going on for
commercial.
How long? I mean, I think the guy definitely has to, you know, has what it takes.
Lady A, since you had the nerve to mention that commercial just quickly, is that guy a monster or what?
Oh, my God.
and by the way, before we forget, the fight's in Europe, so you're gonna have a chance to see it at 4:30 or 4:25 in the afternoon on Saturday, and then it's going to be repeated at 9:30.
I'm going to have to set my DVR, man.
Right.
Who's covering it? HBO or Showtime?
HBO.
I think it's HBO.
I'm
going
to set my DVR because I got to work.
Right. Yeah.
So you know something, in a way I would like to see Hay win, only because it would be exciting to have somebody with his style. As much as I think Klitschko has the edge, the guy, and I'm going to say this about Doxboy, I know he's not going to like it, but he... Boring. Hey, he said this and it was true. Boring. And
exactly.
I know Doc's not going to like this one, but I got to say this. Great defensive fighter, but Floyd, boring.
Exactly.
I mean, the guy gives you the shoulder, a little jab here, a little step to the side there.
And he ties you up and he holds you. Man, and spins, gets out of the way, but that's what it is. But
Lady A, when's the last time we had somebody as exciting as, say, Mike Tyson?
I'm going to tell you something. Doc and I were talking about that. I don't think that. Listen, if you guys would have been with C-Wings and me 2 weekends ago, you guys would have been, forget it. It was amazing. The guy just brought and put butts in the seats. He put butts in the seats. Boxing has never been the same since he's left.
You're right, exactly. He's
just
a
card draw, man. The guy draws a crowd. People want to see. You know what it is
about
boxing? You don't know what it is about boxing. People want to see knockouts.
Mike Tyson was the last great heavyweight champion.
Doc, people want to see knockouts, Doc. Right?
They want to see knockouts.
And Tyson had it.
Tyson
Let me tell you what Emmanuel Stewart said. Emmanuel Stewart said, I couldn't wait to get home on a Friday night to see Mike Tyson knock somebody out. I didn't know who it was going to be, but I couldn't wait to get home on a Friday night to see Mike Tyson. He was the last great heavyweight. Bill Gallo.
Oh, man, I miss Bill Gallo so much. My heart aches, man. I wanted to just see him. Bill Gallo, I have an interview. I'll tape it. And Bill, he said, Mike Tyson was the last guy who had the charisma, the talent, and the grasp of the people. That he was the guy who liked Foreman, who liked Frazier, who liked Ali, who liked Marciano, who liked Floyd Patterson, who liked Jack Johnson, who liked Joe Louis. You were always cognizant, Sonny, listen, and aware of where the heavyweight champ. Today, you know, Mike Tyson at Yankee Stadium. Hey, last Friday in Helsinki, Germany, Muhammad Ali, you always knew what and where the heavyweight champ of the world was going to do. And Mike was that last guy.
He was
the last guy. Mike
last...
got screwed.
Yeah.
He got screwed.
You know something? You want to know when it is? You know when you can absolutely tell a great fighter, panel? You can tell a great fighter when before they're fighting, you know they're coming on next, there is buzz in the audience, big time buzz.
There's
excitement.
But
you know what? That's why I think everybody's like so into Pacquiao, because it's like guys are like, listen, this guy, you know, but like we were saying before, he's no Mike Tyson. I don't think he's Mike Tyson.
A lot of Pacquiao and a lot of Mayweather is hype. You didn't need no hype for Mike. You didn't need no hype for Arthur Lekonte told me in the day of Ali to sell a magazine out. All you had to do was put Ali on. You have to have a story inside. Just put Ali's face on the cover. That's all.
Let me ask you guys a question. This is a question that I've always wanted to ask. You guys are very into all the sports and pretty much knowledgeable in pretty much every sport. What exactly is it about every era that you could turn around and say has allowed these guys to be at the top of their game for so long? Because you look at a guy like Mike Tyson, you put him in a world like today. Hey, you know what? What differentiates these fighters throughout all these years? And what about in other sports? What makes them be so successful
guys,
for so long?
Mike Tyson was the last, and Dusty can give. Mike Tyson was the last guy who not only had the talent, but he knew this. He was a student. Ali was a student. When Ali walked, hey, there go Willie Pastrami. Ali and Tyson and Duran, and they were students. They knew who came before them. They were old school like Dusty.
What makes Tiger Woods so great?
Because, once again, beyond his talent, Tiger knows the history of the game. He knows Jack Nicklaus. He knew about Tom Kite. He knew about Arnold Palmer. And then his dad trained him from an early age.
Wayne Gretzky. Wayne Gretzky. What made him so
Wayne
great?
Gretzky. I mean, the bottom line, all these guys had the great God-given talent. That's the bottom line, you know. But
guys,
these
guys came in at the time that was ripe to make them great. You take
them
like Tyson
Dusty,
again.
Dusty, it's like you too, Dusty.
Joe Montana.
They knew their sport. They knew their business. They were fans.
They were students.
Exactly.
He
studied the game.
He knew Willie O'Ree. He knew Bobby Orr. He knew the Rocket.
Exactly.
And this is what Tyson was. I mean, he had access to Jim Jacobs' films. Jim Jacobs had the most extensive library on boxing in the history of the sport.
Tyson
was a student.
Great Films Incorporated, whatever their name is.
Yeah, whatever.
He owned
the entire collection. Tyson still a great to this day. If Tyson walks into a room and he sees me, he asks me about my daughter. You know, I mean, you know, between the two, you know, Tyson is a more personable and nicer guy than Evander Holyfield.
Exactly.
I've heard stories about Evander.
Mike is the type of guy that from day one, and remember, he lost the box off, and he didn't make it to the Olympics. So that didn't deter him.
But
he lost it to Henry Tillman. I still think he was robbed, Doug Castino.
You,
he lost
yeah,
it
was a
fight
close
to Henry
fight.
Tillman.
I still think
he was robbed.
Cut the tag team stuff
fight.
Here now. Cut it out.
But when he started fighting, remember, I don't know exactly, remember that his first 14, 15, 16, 17 fights were all knockouts, and most of them, somebody correct me, were in the first round.
A lot of them were, but you know what? Hold it. But you see something, Dusty? 50, he had some fights. He was fighting regular. I mean, fighting steady, man. Mike stayed in the ring.
That's what made him the marquee fighter. Everybody
the marquee fighter, and he got a chance, as you did in your area, he got a chance to practice and study his craft.
Exactly.
And, Doc, the first real big fight that he had that folks don't mention, but this really toughened Mike up for the big stage against Trevor Burbick, was in. Nobody remembers this guy.
Come on, Rudy, let it go.
Strong,
let it go.
A big, strong cowboy
come
named
on, Rudy,
James
let it go.
Quick-tillis.
Let it go.
Quick-tillis.
Who? Who was
Quick-tillis.
It?
Quick-tillis.
Sheriff Quick-tillis.
Not only that, he fought a guy bigger and with speed. Yeah, Rooney, Rooney, know what? Forget the suspension. You come on back next week. You're back in. Don't worry about it.
Thank you, sir. What about Mitch Green?
You know why James Quick-tillis was so tough, panel? Because anybody who has enough guts to ride bulls said, I'll fight him, like,
yeah.
And Dusty, you bring a point up. You know, people may say Mitch Blood may not have been 100%, but Mitch Blood was a tough fight. Mike didn't duck anybody.
No,
bring him to me. I'll fight him. You know. One thing about Jacobson. I mean, now Harold said, you know, they were trying to do something with the boom, boom, boom. But yeah, I look at his resume, man. You know, Mike wasn't fighting no, as they say in this fight. He wasn't fighting no choaches. I mean, we may get cut off, so we do. That's because of the time slot. We're going to keep talking.
Well, let me just say this then right quickly before we go. You know, I'm not putting my own chest out, but I knew that Michael Spinks had no chance. But I was shocked that there were a lot of people who thought that
I thought Spinks had a chance. But what Spinks said after that fight, I'll never forget. He said, and it was showed the student that Tyson was. He said, when he dropped me the first time, I got up. He said, but then I was looking for him to come with the right over the left. He came with the left over the right. Tyson Mike Tyson was not a brute. Mike Tyson is like Duran. Duran in that ring is a scientist. He's a genius. And Mike Tyson was that Mike Tyson.
Some people were thinking Larry Holmes was going to beat Mike Tyson, and I was like, no, that didn't even go.
Larry Holmes don't beat Mike Tyson if they're both at their best. I don't think Larry.
Right.
Holmes
that would have been a great fight.
Mark,
that would have been a great fight, though, Doc.
See, the question mark there is that Mike Tyson fought Larry Holmes, and Larry Holmes on the way out.
Dusty, what I'm trying to get you to understand is what I'm saying, had they both fought at their apex, 23 years old, I like Mike in that fight.
And
you know what makes a difference, Dusty? It's a 15 rounder.
Yeah,
it's a 15
rounder.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the difference. Dusty, if Mike fights the Larry Holmes that had that incredible Rocky-type law war with Ken Norton to win the title, that's the Larry Holmes that Mike needs to have for it.
That fight could have went either way.
Yep.
That fight, the Mike Tyson Mike didn't take no. Mike was, you couldn't hit. That's what made you so mad about the little sucker. You couldn't hit him. You couldn't
hit
his defense.
He's a bobbing
weaver. You couldn't hit him. He's bobbing and weaving. He's hitting you back. This little sucker's hit, you know. You know who was a hell of a fighter and really could have been. And I heard, I worked with a great guy. You know, Tony Tucker. Tony Tucker's problem, he got into a drug thing, and they said it was his dad that led him to the cocaine.
What about Ronaldo Snipes?
It was a party
man. Snipes is outstanding. Snipes, the unfortunate thing for Snipes was
gentleman
when he hit Larry Holmes, he didn't hit him in the middle of the ring. He hit him
near the ropes, and Larry fell against the ropes. Had he hit Larry and Larry hit the canvas, there's a good chance Larry wouldn't have got up. But he, remember that?
Dusty would have knocked him out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, see, but he hit Larry, and Larry had a chance to, the ropes cushioned the fall. But had he hit Larry in the middle of the ring and Larry hit the canvas, he might have had a chance. But then again, you know, Larry, but you know, Dusty, huh?
Well, Ron Snyder,
you know, too,
Dusty,
Lady A, and Rooney, but, you know, Larry got up off of Ernie Shaver's shot. I asked Larry, I was in the office, I said, Larry, I said, I heard that you said, you know, when you got hit by Ernie Shaver's, you thought like a bolt of lightning, he said, because some flash bulbs went off. Larry said, I don't know what I thought it was, but you know, he got up off. The thing about Larry, though, Larry always got up, though. Larry always got up. Go ahead,
always
go ahead,
got
Rooney.
Up.
Baby.
No, I was
going
to
say,
you're
going to say something, Coco, about that.
Hey, lady, I'll be brief. No, I was going to say what ruined Mr. Snipes was after that tremendous showing against Holmes, while he was protesting and yelling and screaming after the match was over that they stopped it too fast, somebody at ringside had some scissors for something.
Yeah.
And if you guys remember, man, something happened and somehow he had some type of accident while he was throwing his hands around or something, and the damn scissors...
cut
his arm. His damn arm and messed up somebody's vein artery.
He
was never the same.
Yeah.
Really? What a freak accident.
Who got cut? The
Ronaldo,
Mr.
Snipes.
That's a freak accident, right. Really?
You're right.
He got into a shoving match with one of Larry Holmes' corner
right.
man.
Right, yeah, good job.
And
that's
the corner man
yeah.
had the scissors in his hand. And they were tussling. And accidentally, it wasn't
you
an accident.
You know, world,
this
is why my panel is the best. This is why my panel is the best there is. They know everything.
Right.
They have the answer. You can't be sports and death nation. You know, you can't beat this crew. They are the best of all time. I'm sorry, crew, continue. That's it. You can come back next week, too.
And I saw it because it was on TV that day, and I saw it.
It was,
and they got into a tussle, and when he moved his hand, he cut him deep on his forearm. And if I'm not mistaken, it was to pinpoint it, it was his left forearm. That's the one. And
not only do we have, you know, something that's not only do as Doc says our great panel. Not only do we have the guys just bringing it home, we have the first lady of boxing here, Lady A.
Lady A. And that basically what ruined his career because he went plastic surgery, tied up the nerves, tied up the veins, and he was never the same again. He did make a comeback. I think he won two or three other fights, but then he got knocked out.
Yeah, that's
from
at the Garden once. Yeah.
And Mr. Snipes. But he was a tough contender, man, and that fight could have gone either way.
He came to fight that day, and he wasn't intimidated by Larry either.
Yeah, exactly. And he was demanding a rematch. I said, my God, if he hadn't gotten cut in his forearm, they would have had a rematch. But yeah, Mr. Snipes.
What a freak accident, huh?
It really was a freak accident. And then, you know, those scissors are hospital scissors, which they have a blunt tip on them. So you just cut the tape. But it just so happens that the sharp edge of the scissors was the one that went right into his forearm. And I mean, it's so crazy because we're seeing that, we're watching it, and we're seeing security run and rush, and all of a sudden everybody was holding his arm with a towel and he was bleeding
right.
like a stuck thing.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my Lord, what happened? Then the next day we read in the paper what had happened, and they were trying to sue or get the guy arrested, but the guy was defending himself. He just happened to play his hands with the scissors. And they blamed Snipes anyway for starting it.
You know, it's shocking, you know. And in those shocking things that I've seen in sports watching live, I was horrified. I think, Doc, that I was watching Bob Gibson one day, and something happened. I don't know if he threw his back out his arm or what, but he tried to throw the ball again like a practice pitch and fell down. That was the last game that he ever pitched, and they carried him off the field.
Wow.
And then I also remember someone pitching. And as they threw the ball,
yeah,
they
broke
their arm in mid-pitch.
Yes, I remember that. I also remember another freak accident.
Yeah.
There was a freak accident also. I don't know if it was, it was the guy from Boston, guys, right? Where he pitched the ball, and the second the ball came off the bat, caught him right in the eye socket, and he went down. He was screaming agony.
Carabino?
Yeah, was it the picture of
Rocky Calavito?
Yeah, and it's and they had towels and towels drenched in blood.
Yeah, Rocky Calavito.
You know what surprised that lady
base.
And Dusty? Dusty, you know I'm surprised that you lady A. I'm really surprised that that doesn't happen to more pitchers.
Yeah, me too.
I mean,
because
what
they got such a close range.
Yeah, what are you, 60 feet, 6 inches away throwing 90 and 100 mile an hour fastball? I'm surprised that doesn't happen to more pitchers, thank goodness.
But it does
that was a real freak accident. That guy was never the same, though, either.
He could never play ball again.
Yeah.
He could never play ball.
Young kid, too. He was young.
Yeah. I believe it was Calavito, a guy named Calavito.
You know, Lady A and Dusty, the first time that I knew you really had to have heart to play baseball, I was at Yankee Stadium. And like Doc said, the reliever was Goose Gossage. He came in and he struck out the side on 9 pitches. And I remember that's the time when you would take your little transistor radio to the game with you and listen to Phil Rizzuto and Bill White. And I remember them clocking this guy. Yeah, Dustin, I remember them clocking Goose at like 101 miles an hour.
Yeah, you know, speed's that fast, man. That's crazy. It's like I was watching the you know how you guys know like the end of every year they show the greatest sports event, like the greatest sports like follies and like stuff like that. I was watching one time and they said this guy slid on the ice rink while he was playing hockey and cut the jugular vein of one of the goalies.
And with a skate.
Yeah.
With a skate.
I would have never. That's a real freak accident. I would have never imagined something like that happening.
Because when he slid, his leg went up, and caught the guy's neck. I mean, close to his jugular vein, and he's lucky to be alive, man.
Yeah, they said
the truth really is stranger than fiction. I'm watching one time about crazy sports plays. And this guy is really getting his butt kicked. This is a boxer. I wish I could remember his name. Really getting his head handed to him. I think they were heavyweights. No big names, nondescript heavyweights. Guy getting his head handed to him. His mom got so sick of it, she took off her shoe and charged
him. Yeah, I remember that.
She smacked this guy at 5
years.
I was seeing that.
Right. She went after the dude with her shoe.
Yeah, he had a shoe.
Exactly. No, the shoe. Are you sure it was heavyweights and it wasn't Griffith's mother, Emil Griffith's mother? No.
No. This was. I know what you're talking about. They had a special on that recently, but this one was more. Yeah, they had Emil Griffith. They talked about his mother in a recent thing in ESPN Classic.
Yeah, Emil Griffith.
Yeah. This was more of a recent fight, Doc.
This is way more recent than that.
Yeah,
this
is more like the '80s and '90s.
Yeah, this is more like an hour time. And then she's seen this guy just get the bejesus getting beat out of him, the tar out of him. And she takes off
a
heel.
That was hilarious.
And smacked this guy upside the neck, doesn't he?
He beat the tar out with her shoe. Oh, that was
with
so funny.
With
a
shoe.
Yeah.
Leave my son alone. Do. I heard it took it up for family, but this is ridiculous.
That's crazy, man.
I mean, truth really is strange. You know, the things that happen in the sports world.
It is. Amazing, right?
I mean, it's absolute craziness goes on.
Yeah.
And do you ever hear the corners talk like yesterday? I mean, do you ever hear the corners in between rounds telling their guys what to
Larry,
do?
Larry Merchant and Roy Jones were laughing, man, all the way they were talking about this guy. You kill this MF, man. Kill him. And knock him out. I don't care what you do. You kill him. Get him and do this. But you got to do this for him. You got to knock him out. Man, crazy.
And you heard the part that they were from Philly, and the guys were bragging about themselves about, don't worry about what that bleep is going to talk about. They can't teach him a damn thing. They don't know what they're talking about over there. Listen to us.
Oh, my God. That was so
they
funny.
They were ragging the other corner.
Kill that MF, man.
Unbelievably funny.
Yeah.
What did you think about the Devin Alexander fight? You thought that was.
I'm glad you. In Maidana. There you go, Maidana again. Matisse. In fact, Maidana and him were teammates in Argentina in the Junior Olympics. Anyway, and Maidana beat Matisse in the Olympics. He beat him for an Olympic playoff, whatever. Anyway, I felt that Matisse won. But it was so close that I would have called it a draw.
A draw.
But,
yeah, I had it as a draw, actually.
Devin Alexander, no way, won that fight. But, you know, the irony behind ironies, they exchanged fights. I called 2 of the rounds even. So when I tallied it up at the end of the fight,
I found myself giving Alexander the fight 95-94.
And I know that's possible. That is possible.
Yeah.
But you know something,
I
will say without question, Dust and Lady, I think without question it was Mathis who threw the more meaningful, more hurtful punches, who landed the bigger punches.
Mm.
But you see what it is, that Alexander is a faker. Why do I say faker? He's these guys who throw punches and bunches. And blah, 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 and then he screams. Blah, 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 blah. And that impresses the judges. And boom. Blah, 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 and impresses the judges. Now, Batiste was his own enemy because he threw three or four bombs with one punch. He didn't throw them in combinations. If he had thrown them in combinations, I think he would have stopped Alexander by the eighth or ninth round. And mind you, Alexander was aware that this was only a 10-round fight. If it had been an 12-round fight, Batiste would have won. If not by knockout, he would have won by decision because he had him battered all the way into the 10th. But Alexander,
well, I really wasn't impressed with any of the guys who won yesterday.
No.
I mean, it was like the heavyweights yesterday, the big guy Austin and them.
The
guy was beating
monster?
This guy. This guy was beating up Stavron so much with the jab. I mean,
exactly.
This guy Stavron, before he finally knocked this guy out in the 10th Lady A, Stavron was eating jabs like I eat cornflakes.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, this guy.
I'm telling you, he was beating them. And then Austin gets tired. He got slapped by the side of his head, and he went down, and he couldn't get up. And
really?
Then the guy says, get up, walk towards me. He wouldn't walk towards me. And he walked. The guy said, oh, no, I got to stop this.
And what's so funny about it, Dusty, is every time Stavron hit him with the least. Now, they list this guy, Lady A, at 6'5 and 238. So that's 6'5 and 240, all
right?
Right. 238 is a big guy. And every time Stavron tagged him. Yeah, and Dust, every time you saw the fight, I guess, every time Stavron so much as tagged this dude, his legs would do the cha-cha-cha.
Exactly. I would run back, boom. And then the second fight, Mac and Cloud. Yusef Mac, you know, that's another guy. I mean, he lost four fights, and the four fights he lost are all by knockouts. He doesn't have any staying power. In fact, I think Glenn Johnson knocked him out.
Speaking of, you saw that fight with Glenn Johnson and Frye?
Oh,
yeah,
that was,
yeah.
And, you know, they could have called it a draw, but they didn't want to because they wanted somebody to fight Andre Ward. But one of the judges called it a draw. It was that close.
I thought Glenn Johnson really worked his behind off on that fight.
Oh, he really put a hurt.
They really
on
put on
Frye.
A good show. I thought so.
Yeah. But,
from Lady A and Costino, you were a championship fighter. Glenn Johnson is one of those nobody wants to fight.
Yes.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. He wanted durable Jamaicans, and he gave Crush. In fact, I got to give Crush a kudos because he wasn't going to mix with Glenn Johnson. Remember, he stayed outside. He stayed outside and just jabbed him and threw a few punches and jabbed him and grabbed him.
Listen, the right terminology is, Frotch outboxed him, but Johnson out-hustled him. He really did.
Right.
I mean, I thought that. And then, you know what, there was a time, Dusty, I don't know if you caught, like, and Coco, I don't know if you guys caught, like, maybe the fourth or fifth round, where Glenn Johnson was just taking away all the angles. There was no way for Frotch to go. There was no way for him to go.
I'm pounding him. I'm pounding him. And when Frotch got hit, he ran away. He ran away and starts taking the jab because I don't know what is in Johnson. He loves jabs because he was eating jabs for lunch. He couldn't get away from the jabs.
I like Ward. I like Ward in that championship. I like Ward more. I think that I do.
Well,
Frye.
Yeah.
So who you picking in that fight?
I like Andre Ward.
Andre Ward.
I don't
know about Ward and Frye.
Ward against who?
Carl Frosch. Yeah, the Colbert.
I like Ward. I think Ward is stronger. I think he can. I don't think Frotch can keep him off him.
I just think that Ward is a better boxer. And using that terminology, you guys can kind of figure out what I'm trying to say.
Isn't he too the harder puncher?
Yeah, and I think he probably.
He's a harder puncher. I thought Frosch was a harder puncher, and he's taller and he got a longer arms.
Well, he's got the reach. Frost definitely has the reach.
But
think
being taller and having the reach and to hit down can be disadvantage, especially when the other guy is a more talented guy.
Yeah, well, yeah, he's more talented.
Well, I think Ward is more talented than Holland again.
Dusty, you think he's got a stronger punch than Ward?
Yeah, Frost.
I could kind of agree with you on that.
Well, I think Frost may have a better jab, but I don't think he hits harder than Ward does. He may have a better jab. Maybe his punches a lot of. But I think Ward is just
a better boxer.
He's a better boxer.
Hold on.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world. To the world. To the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com. All day, all night, all the time. BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul.
Gang, we're about to hit the three-hour mark here. You want to keep it going or should we close it down at 3? You let me know. We can keep it rolling.
Oh, I got doctors tomorrow, so I think I'm going to close.
All right.
Yeah, but we can go out forever, man. I wish it was Saturday night.
Yeah. Well, it's that time in the background, the Dear Lord theme. We're giving you 3 hours. And the last hour has been done with solid boxing by the sweet first lady of boxing, the incomparable Lady A, of course, the body slammer himself, little Coco Mel Smith Jr. And I'm trying to get you to see the man from back in the day, who always has a day, the steel baby, Lois. Thank our guest, Harvey Former, legendary baseball historian and sports writer. His latest book is his venue on Fenway Park. Amazing, the guys remember Fenway Park, and he's the guy who remembered Yankee Stadium. And the great thing he brought up, too, was the fact that Monty Irvin, who was looked upon as the first guy to break the baseball color line, and he told me this when we first met, during the book with Yankee Stadium. He said, Monty told him, I couldn't do what Jackie did. I'd have killed somebody.
Exactly. But you remember the biography where the guy says he plays Branch Rickey and he says, look, you're going to get booed, you're going to get this, that, and the other. I need you to understand that you got to take it. And this is possibly the character that Jackie Robinson had.
The thing is that...
I would have been a Monty Irvin.
A lot of guys would have been. I read in Hal Jackson's book that, that Jackie had thought about letting it go. And one of the things that was advantageous to him coming to the big leagues, because forget the gentleman that the great Larry Hardesty had on his show, and he told Jackie, look, hey, understand something. When you go to the big leagues, when you go to where the white boys are, there's certain things that they can't do to you. As far as like in the Negro leagues, they could throw close to you, they could use certain tricks on the ball. They can't do it. Certain regulations are going to be advantageous to you to be able to display your talent. And the rest they say. Jackie was the first ever Rookie of the Year. 1947. 2 years later, he won the National League Batting Champion, the first African American to win the Batting Championship, and he also led the league in stolen base. A lot of the fielding records that Joe Morgan eclipsed and other players down the line were done by Jackie Robinson at second base. Boxing has been the forte once again. I also want to thank John D. Hirsch. We're looking for a couple other callers to get in, but hey, once we get the crew talking about the sweet science, it don't matter, baby. We keep doing what we got to do. It's near the big three. Closing thoughts, Dusty, real quick. Anything you want to say real quick while we close it up?
Well, it's healthy and it's gratifying that these things happen. I'm glad you brought in other folks that are in a different venue but can enhance and lighten up, what we got. And we can integrate with what they have because here the man wants to get in with what we're doing. So we're going to sponsor him and godfather him into one of the press conferences so he can build up his repertoire.
What we got to do? Maybe we can get him to do a drawing of the posse, get a picture of everybody. Because Lady D kept telling me she needs a picture of the posse. Not that going to be great. A nice picture of the posse. Lady A sitting there with her Bell Star brim, you with the shotgun, little Coco with shotgun, part two sold off, of course. three wings with a long rifle. Hey, you know, we got to get it done. Lady A, some thoughts there, lady, first lady.
No, I was very impressed with the guest today that we had, the artist. I mean, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, you do have other people in other areas that can kind of
absolutely
contribute, you know, and
you know,
they are active.
Harvey asked to be on the show. You know, we've been emailing, and he said, hey, Doc, you know, what's the possibility of getting on your show? I said, well, you know, send a check for $500, a Doc stamp. You know what I mean? And you in. I said, my panel got to eat. They got to eat, baby.
You better watch it, Doc. Soupy Sales once got in trouble saying something similar about 30 years ago.
Yeah, you know, this ain't Soupy Sales, baby, and my real name is Larry Johnson III.
Hey, Doc, in closing, I just want to say it's always an honor being on the panel, and that when we have all of the great fans around the globe that honor us with their listenership here in the Sports In Depth Nation, it means when we're on the air, it means, Doctor, only one thing.
Good one.
Big things popping, little things stopping.
Rooney, let me say something, Rooney. A point well taken. And like I said, man, you know, Harvey, you know, then email, hey, Doc, you know, can I get on your radio show? And then John, I met down at a thing with Leroy Neiman, and I said, hey, you know, I'm doing the author. Let me bring him. And he calls. He was ecstatic, and thanks so much for being on. And, no, we get some other people. Like, we did the show this week, too, from St. Louis. Got Alan Harper, who won the PR Man Award.
Oh, yeah.
That year.
Wow.
Yeah.